And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and I'd like to welcome a new guest host today, Matt Ward. Today we have the conversation between Matt and Louis Ferrante, the author of three previous books, including his memoir, Unlocked: The Life and Crimes of a Mafia Insider, which dealt with being a member of the Gambino crime family. They will be discussing the first book of his planned trilogy about the history of La Cosa Nostra in the United States. The title of the first installment is Borgata, Rise of Empire, A History of the American Mafia, which is published by Pegasus Books.
Before we dive into the material in the book, which is extensive, I'd like to talk maybe a little bit about where you're from and your life experiences in organized crime, but also personally from your neighborhood. How did it come to pass that that was your path? Was it largely involved with your family ties, or was it a big part of the neighborhood, or was it a little more of a sort of personal choice and aspiration in your youth?
I guess all of the above. I grew up in Queens, New York, and I came from a very Italian-American family. My father's parents, my paternal grandparents, were first-generation immigrants to the United States. They came on a boat, and they came following World War One. My grandfather, my father's father, fought in World War One.
Oh, wow.
On the Austrian front. Yeah, interesting. And came here after the war. Actually, he went home and found that most of his family was wiped out. I think it was cholera.
Oh, my. Oh, wow.
Yeah. And he took his youngest sister, who was alive, and left. And then he eventually sent for my grandmother and brought her over. So it's Italian-American family. My father was from Bari, his family. My mother's family, my maternal grandmother was Sicilian, and my maternal grandfather was Napolitan from Naples, Neapolitan.
Right.
So there was a sort of mix. The Italian city-states up and down the peninsula of Italy, always throughout history, they identified strongly with wherever they were from, whatever
sure.
regions they were from, whether it be Florence, Tuscany, Calabria.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I still experienced that in my youth. People would ask me, where are you from? Meaning, where are your ancestors from? And say, being able to say three places, Bari, Naples, and Sicily, it usually increased my chances of being acceptable to some people, while others considered me a mutt.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's just interesting. So I grew up in this Italian-American household. There was a strong tradition of Italian cuisine, Italian words, Italian phrases. My father spoke fluent Italian to his parents, who never learned English as long as they were in this country. My grandmother lived till she was 104. So
wow.
She was born in the age of Napoleon, 1898, and died in the age of Bin Laden, 2002.
That's amazing.
To give you an idea. Yeah, incredible. And never learned English. So it was difficult for me to talk to her because I never learned Italian. So, you know, I struggled, but I would have my father there as the interpreter throughout my life, as well as my cousins and stuff, too. We all communicated the same way. So it was very Italian-American. My father's side were all law-abiding, hardworking, honest immigrants to the United States, as I said. His parents were. My father and his seven siblings, all law-abiding. And my mother's side was a little crooked. My grandfather, who my mother was 7 years younger than my father, and her father fought in World War II. He won 8 Bronze Stars in the Asiatic Pacific, came home from the war.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And I guess he had seen it all, done it all.
Sure.
And from there on, he just operated heavy machinery. His friends got him into the union. Back then, there was a strong mafia influence in the union. They got
sure.
him a job. So he drove heavy equipment, helped build, you know, worked in the Midtown Tunnel, BQE, all the early projects. He hung out in a bar at night and took numbers. That I knew. So he was a little crooked. If something fell off the truck, he showed up at the house with some stuff and my mother would, you know, get it out. I don't want it. My mother was very law-abiding.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah, she didn't want that stuff. I remember her saying to me once when I drove home with a brand new Cadillac Eldorado that I had just tagged. Tag job, for your listeners who don't know, is we would buy a wrecked car with a clean title. And then instead of repairing the car, we would just pop the VIN number off underneath the windshield in the front of the dash. Yeah, and then steal a car that was identical and put that new VIN on the stolen car so we could drive it. And unless auto crime pulled you over and did a real thorough check of the vehicle, typically if you got pulled over for a red light or a speeding ticket even, regular cops just took the VIN in the dashboard and took a look at it with their flashlight and then sent you on your way with a ticket. So nobody
right.
ever caught you. So I had a stolen Eldorado I came home with when I was young. And I remember my mother looking out the window and she came out the porch and she said, "You're breaking my heart." She goes, "My family was crooked and they broke my heart and you're doing the same thing." And I said, "No, Mom, what are you talking about?" I
wow.
said, I said, "My friend Ciro owns a body shop and I help him around the shop and he gave me the car. I'm paying it off." And
yeah, but she knew better.
She knew.
Yeah,
she knew.
Yeah.
So it hurts me to this day because she ended up dying young. She died in my arms when she was 47.
Oh,
I
man.
Was 20 years old. Yeah, 1920. So that really beat me up.
Sure.
But anyways, I was stealing cars throughout high school. I eventually graduated to running a chop shop. The auto body collision shops which were rife in College Point, Queens. There was a lot of them. They were in Flushing too, but most of the guys I dealt with were in College Point, Queens. They would order parts from me. So they would give me an order. Let's say, for example, an auto body collision shop is working on two or three Mercedes Benzes and two or three BMWs. The parts for those vehicles are extremely expensive if you go to the dealer.
Sure.
Or even if you buy the aftermarket parts. Yeah. So they could typically give us the car that they needed the year. And they could even give us the color if we're able to match the color. That even helps too.
Sure.
In some instances, you could save them the paint job. Sometimes they had to repaint the car anyway if you couldn't get it exact, if there wasn't enough parts. But whatever the case was, we would try to match the color. So anyway, I ran a chop shop. And this is through high school. After high school, I started hijacking trucks. And it all started because I was in the body shop business with these guys. The car business, I should say, chop shop business with right. The body shops. There were these giant tool trucks, tool chests, rather, that the mechanics kept their tools in. And some of them were as tall as me. One day in conversation, I understood that they go for like $5,000 or $6,000, these things. And the tools are a few hundred dollars. And the trucks probably have $100,000 worth of merchandise on them at any given time. So
yeah, and that'll perk your ears up, right?
Yeah. So do you want one? I was a wild kid. That's where it started. He said, sure. And I hijacked a tool truck. I graduated to hijacking and I put together a crew. I had some guys in my neighborhood that were older guys that did, you know, a few years in jail when I was a kid. And now they're older. They got out of jail and they're doing like stick ups that aren't really paying anything.
Right.
And I figured if I start putting together good scores, I got these guys. So I started hijacking trucks. I started doing heists and eventually through a network of affiliations, I put together a really solid crew. I met other guys that did this. And because I was able to put together a plan and get the tips and stuff, you know, I grilled everybody I knew if they knew something. And then eventually tips came to me. People would come to me. Yeah, you know, if somebody does payroll, it's $300,000 on Friday in cash, you know, but even if it was $50,000, $100,000, or there's a truck coming out of Kennedy Airport at such and such a time. Sometimes there were quote unquote give ups where the driver would give us the truck and pretend to have been robbed. Sometimes the eat-in door, you know, a little grilling. Sometimes they would want to put him on a polygraph test and then he'd just quit and act like he was frustrated with the accusation. Or sometimes he was about to quit and he'd want to, you know, engage with us before he quit. And sometimes it was just a pure and simple stick up where we would get a tip on a truck. We knew what the merchandise was worth and we would just take the driver and we would let the driver know. I talk about this very casually now. 30 years have passed. So it's something in my deep, deep past. But I had great regrets when I first went to prison and I started to reflect on this life that I led. And that's what led to me transforming into a completely different life, the life I lead now. And that's where it all began when I had those regrets. So I just want to make sure I reassure you and your listeners that this comes with a great deal of regret. But getting back to the story, back then, I didn't think of that. You know, I loved my family. I loved my friends. I would do anything for them. I cared deeply for my family and friends. But everybody else seemed to me as fair game. But once we did take a driver, we would always assure that person that we didn't want you. We want the truck. We promise we won't hurt you. There was one instance, the first tool truck I stole, the guy said to us, it was with a few friends of mine and we were driving and we were really polite to the guy. We assured him we would never hurt him. And we asked him if there was anything in the truck that he needed. And he said, yeah, there's pictures of my family on the sun visor. Give them to me. And there's some records in the glove compartment I need and et cetera. And at some point he said, you know, you guys are really nice guys. You ever think this stuff will catch up with you? And it was the first time we'd done it.
Wow.
Yeah, exactly. Talk about
irony. What a prophetic, an ironic interaction.
Yeah. So it took years before that statement, I was able to reflect on it. And the first time I did reflect on it and recalled it was in a prison cell, in the hell of prison, in the midst of prison where I went to the worst prison in the United States. I was in one prison. They classified me as a violent felon. And at the time I had a number of cases. At one point I had three violent felonies against me. I was able to reverse one of the cases. I eventually had two. They sent me to Lewisburg Penitentiary, which was the maximum security prison. One of the worst prisons at the time in the United States.
Yeah, it's a notorious place.
Yeah. And my very first day in the general population, the Aryan Brotherhood hacked to death two black Muslims, you know, with homemade, prison-made, I should say, machetes.
Wow.
That they made from a metal shop. Believe it or not, they had a metal shop back then in Lewisburg that made things like lockers, bunk beds, and machetes in their spare time. So that was wild. That was my first day in population, a double homicide. So just to give you an idea of some of the places I was in, very violent. I've seen things that I would rather forget, probably will never forget.
I'm sure, yeah.
Yeah, so somebody's face slashed one time. Somebody melted two razors onto a toothbrush so that there would be a double incision down the guy's face. You know, double the pain, double the goriness, and harder to heal. He slashed somebody in front of me with a double razor. It was a horrible sight. So, you know, things like that, piece of meat hanging off somebody's flesh. So the prison system in America is horrible. There are other countries around the world. I've done a little bit of studying on this, and there are other countries around the world that have put a great deal of effort into making the prison system a better place where it reforms the criminal.
Right.
We have a high rate of recidivism because we really don't care. We just,
absolutely.
We warehouse. Yeah. And it's a horrible thing. I've tried to make inroads into helping. I used to offer my services for free all the time to the Bureau of Prisons, federal and the state prison here in New York and other states.
Sure.
Nobody wanted to hear my advice. You know, nobody wanted my help. In contrast, the British government did a lot. They brought me over quite a few times to visit their prisons, to
wow.
advise them. Yeah, which was interesting. You know, it was refreshing to know that there was a country that was interested in doing that. The Scandinavian countries, too, have done some great stuff.
Sure, they're well known to have a very, very different prison environment than we're accustomed to here in America.
That's right. Yeah. And I think the reformation of the inmates attests to the success of it, of their plans so far. But the English actually brought me over enough times that, and I kept going every time they asked me if I could pay back for the horrible things I did in any way, shape, or form. It's trying to reform prisoners. We call the guards hacks in America, in the American prisons. They call them screws. I would always make sure that they understood that, yeah, that their screws have better things to do than babysitting for them. And if the screw is a good guy, take that into consideration and don't treat them so hard, because the screws or slash hacks in the American prisons were given hell sometimes by the inmates. So I tried to establish better relationship with that. Yeah. And at some point or another, I get a phone call from Downing Street, the administration of Gordon Brown. He was prime minister at the time. And they gave me an award for the work I had done in British prisons at 10 Downing Street. So that was really nice, too.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah, opposed to America. I've never been to the White House, never got even a phone call back from the American prisons, and I probably never will. So, you know, we have this haughty attitude here in the States where,
an international best-selling author who's completely reinvented himself and learned from his experiences. I mean, you know, what value is there in that?
That's absurd. Thanks. I know.
And the fact that you're making that much of an effort to give back to the community is really, it's amazing and inspiring. And it's sad. I think it's a testament to the sad quality of state of affairs that we have with our legal and incarceration system here in America. By far the most people incarcerated in the world, and not even close to the highest population in the world, for example.
That's correct.
It's a sad state of affairs. That being said, I'm curious, how were you able to get out of prison prematurely? Because you had a fairly long sentence imposed on you, but you were able to get out prematurely. How did that come to pass?
So I faced life in prison. And just to give a quick note on the backstory, eventually as a hijacker, I did fall in with members of the Gambino crime family, and I began hijacking for the mafia.
Right.
We used to not say the word mafia, but it's something I say now. I'm a writer.
Sure.
Cosa Nostra, Borgata, the Brigade, we used to say. I did heists and scores, hijackings for all five families in New York.
Oh, you did?
I did. I mean, if somebody had a tip, they gave it to me. But my home was the Gambino crime family. That's where I hung my hat.
And was that out of a neighborhood loyalty, or was it personal connections?
Yeah, I mean, when you're on the street, you meet guys from different families. And if somebody knows that we're an efficient armed robbery crew, they might come to us with a tip. I just have to report it to who I answer to in the Gambino family. I'm with the Gambino crime family. But that doesn't mean if somebody from the Bonanno family or the Lucchese family comes to me with a tip, I can't do it. So
right.
I have other relationships with people. And I would do it. I would just put it on record with my own family, and they would know that I did something with this other family. There were a couple of times when something went wrong on a heist or something, and then the two families would have to talk. But as long as it's on record, you know, you established it. If they find out you did something without telling them, that's where you get in trouble.
Right.
So I knew the rules. I learned the rules pretty quick, and I knew them, so I understood them. So as far as prison is concerned, when eventually I was investigated for a lot of heists and hijackings, I had a fence in Manhattan, and he went south. He was an older man, probably in his 60s at the time. He would be in his 90s or 100 now, so I'm assuming he's either passed on or he's very, very old. He was one of the biggest fences, just to give you an idea, too. 47th Street, Manhattan, is the jewelry district.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, the most concentration of gold, diamonds, silver.
A lot of money changing hands in that district.
Yeah, all day long. Given that, there's always a criminal element, right, that's attracted to where the money is. So there was like five or six big fences on that square block who could move anything, you know. And then he was one of the biggest premier of all of them. For example, if you went to them, these guys down there, you might go to a guy in Queens and say, you know, I have the Stanhope diamond, or I have the Queens jewels, and then what the hell you want me to do with that? I'll get arrested the second I try to move it.
Right.
Whereas these guys knew where to go, what to do, and how to move things, and they moved some of the biggest things. The stories I've heard, forget it. And then I became part of that, those experiences, by bringing them some incredible stuff. And he was the biggest mover and shaker of them all. And when he got arrested for a lot of things, he was facing life. He was an older guy, and he opened up to the FBI and told them all these crimes that were committed by me. And they were all crimes that the FBI at the time had no clue it was me. They were looking at older guys in the mob, like the Jimmy Burke type guys.
Sure.
Jimmy Burke was the guy played by Robert De Niro in the movie Goodfellas, based on the real character Jimmy Burke. I think it was Jimmy Conway, the name in the movie. So they were looking at seasoned wise guys, seasoned mob guys like that for a lot of these crimes. And then they realized it was me, and it's, well, you know, son of a gun, it's this kid. And I was young at the time, I was in my 20s, my early 20s. My crew was much older than me. My crew were in their 30s, 40s, 50s. You know, I had guys working with me. I used different guys for different heists and different hijackings. I had a big network. But my crew overall, if I would have like grouped them all in one room, they spanned from 30s, 40s, and 50s, these guys. So they had been around a long time. I wasn't, but I got the job done. So he was what they called a dry snitch. He was willing to give information, but he wasn't willing to take the stand against anyone, including me. So now the FBI needed to find a real snitch that would testify to make a case. And I tipped my hat to the agents. I hated them back then.
Sure.
I felt like they were encroaching in my world and threatening my freedom and my life. You know, now I have great respect for the agents who worked my case. And they did a phenomenal job of uncovering more stuff that I had done. Basically, eventually I was faced with three separate indictments. So there was an FBI indictment for some of the heists and hijackings, I could say. I did much more than what I was charged with, but for some of them, the ones they were able to make a case on. And then there was a Secret Service case. There was a credit card conspiracy that dealt with these guys that were opening up phony businesses, getting approved to accept credit cards, getting the machines, et cetera, installed in this ghost business, and then running stolen credit cards through the machines until they would rack up 30, 40, 50 grand, whatever they could grab, and make a run for it, then just close it and start it again. And they had been doing this. And then somehow I got roped into that as somebody who was trying to straighten out a problem between two guys who were arguing over money that was owed to them. So I really had nothing to do with the actual conspiracy. They looked for the bigger fish. So I was the big fish, and they ended up calling me the hub of the conspiracy, which I certainly wasn't, but I was the biggest name on the indictment. And they were able to link it through me to organized crime and call it a Gambino family thing and et cetera. That's sort of how it works.
So the biggest target ended up being on your back, so to speak.
Yeah, exactly. So I became a target with that. So I had the Secret Service case, I had the FBI case, and I had a Nassau County Organized Crime Task Force case, which investigated an armed robbery, which stemmed from another conspiracy. Somebody gave us a tip. I did not do the armed robbery. However, I was charged with it. Another one of my co-defendants in the feds did it. I was never going to snitch. So that never came to light. I took the rap for that.
Right. And that's something that's interesting about your past and your incarceration as well, is that you never rolled over on anyone, right?
No, never, never. I never even considered it. It was something that was beneath me. You know, these were friends of mine.
Right.
I look at the people who snitch now, and I'm absolutely amazed that they could do it with such, you know, carte blanche. I don't know what the right phrase would be, just casualness.
Sure.
And, you know, everything was fake.
Quite a few of them out there.
They're everywhere. They're everywhere. And I'm amazed that, you know, why go to the pen when you could send a friend, right? Why suffer consequences? So it's just not me. I could never imagine taking the stand and pointing to my best friends, and so I could go home and they could suffer for the 20 years that I deserve. Just to be clear, if you witness a bank robbery and you have nothing to do with it, you're sitting outside in front of a bank and you're licking an ice cream cone, and bank robbers come running out of the place and they have a shootout or something, you know, I'd be the first to say you're an innocent civilian. You should cooperate with the police. You should tell them everything you saw.
Sure.
But if you participate, if you make the conscious decision to participate in that robbery, you're responsible for your own decisions. You're an adult. If it comes time to pay for those, pay for the damn thing. You got to pay. And they don't feel like they should pay. They always find excuses. Why? I didn't do everything. Well, they want this guy more than they want me. Well, the guy didn't send money to my wife, or he didn't take care of my children while I was in jail, so I'm going to put him in jail. You know, it's all excuses. And it's just basically punking out.
Yeah. It reminds me of the quote that really stuck out to me. I think you mentioned it in the book. Those who inform never reform.
That's true. And because I did never informed, I had all that time ahead of me. And I had that time to really think through the things I had done, regret them, and then begin to educate myself. And the snitches, they get locked up. They give up their best friends. They get out in minutes. And then they're really the same people. You know,
right.
A lot of them go back to crime. Sammy the Bull Gravano, who was the underboss of my family, he's a perfect example.
Sure.
He gets 5 years for 19 murders. He killed some of his best friends, testified against the rest of them.
Yeah, he was a prolific murderer.
Prolific murderer. He goes out after they call him an American hero, quote unquote, an American hero, they called him in the courtroom.
Wow.
A man of honor. And all of these ridiculous phrases that they attach to someone who was completely controlled by self-preservation. After all of these phrases are attached to him, he literally goes out and minutes later starts an ecstasy ring and starts selling drugs to children.
Right.
He never reformed. He informed and never had an opportunity to reform. You know, I don't know. I'd find it hard to believe. Who am I to judge? Maybe he has reformed by now. I don't know. He's just a different creature to me.
Sure.
And a lot of people followed his lead. And I just felt like even after I knew the mob was something that wasn't for me, when I thought about how horrible I felt in prison, I realized that a lot of people were killed and died for no reason at all, which bothered me. I assumed if somebody disappeared or if somebody was killed, there was a good reason for it. And then when I was in prison, when everyone and all their indictments were laid bare and we were able to talk about things because we're all locked up now, you just don't ask questions when you're on the street.
Right.
They'll wonder why. They'll kill you next, thinking maybe you're informing. So you just don't ask questions. But once the indictments are laid bare, I'm asking questions, I'm learning things, and I'm seeing that a lot of people did not have to die. Most of the people died for things like greed. And I said, wow, son of a gun, I could never kill somebody for $1 billion. Could I have killed somebody if you threatened me or my family? Maybe, probably. Most people in America could. Most people right. in the world could.
I've killed for my country. What do you think I'd do for my family? Things like that.
Exactly. Couldn't have said it better. I know somebody who ended up becoming the acting boss of the Colombo family.
Uh-huh.
And he said to his son, when his son was very young, he says, would you kill for your country? And he says, of course I would, Dad. And he said, well, how much more for your own family? So it's a perfect example. You just hit the nail on the head. So yeah, of course, I was capable of that. But you couldn't give me $1 trillion to kill someone for money. That's something that just was not in me.
It's a different breed. Yeah, right.
Yeah, exactly. It's a different form of treachery. I would have felt like a snake. I would have felt like the same way I would have felt as if I ratted on people. And that's why Sammy, I believe, was so easy. He killed friends for money. And that should have been an alert to the people around him. Why wouldn't he testify against the rest of us if it's his ass on the line?
Right. I've watched some of your interviews, and I think that I remember you saying that there was a friend of yours who was in the life also. And I know that you stayed for a time on and off at the Gigantes home.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I can't remember if that's where this happened, but I do remember you maybe having a conversation about Sammy the Bull and then your friend giving you a look and almost like a warning.
Oh, well, that happened. That's exactly right. I was at a retreat, a vacation retreat. With,
uh-huh.
He was actually a high-ranking captain, a capo. And I said Sammy was just made consul, yeah, I think, before he became the underboss. And I said, I was young. You know, so I'm sitting at a picnic table with this older capo who I looked up to, who I respected.
So this would have been right after the hit on Big Paul, right, when they took power?
Oh, it was sometime after that, because first okay. Sammy was made a captain. Then they killed Frankie DiCicco.
Right.
And then Sammy was brought on to the administration. And then at some point, he started out as an acting consulier, then a consulier, then an acting underboss.
Right.
Then he might have been made an underboss at some point. But when he first was brought on to the administration, I remember saying to Joe, I say, hey, Joe, this guy, hey, Joe, how's Sammy? You know, I didn't know Sam. He's from Brooklyn. I'm from Queens. I'm doing my own thing. I got a hijacking heist crew. You know, there's no reason for me to interact with Sammy. So now he's going to start appearing in Queens. The center of power, by the way, just so your listeners understand too.
Uh-huh.
When Paul Castellano was boss, the center of power of the Gambino crime family was in Brooklyn. / Castellano lived in Staten Island, which was sort of like the hoity-toity place where gangsters bought, you know, in the hills of Staten Island overlooking
right.
the Verrazano Bridge. Some of them bought houses. He bought a mansion there. But the center of power was basically in Brooklyn, where he was from. And it had been in Brooklyn for the longest time since Carlo Gambino. Carlo Gambino lived in Brooklyn. So when John Gotti killed Castellano, he shifted the center of power of the Gambino crime family from Brooklyn to Queens, which was smack in the middle of where I was a criminal.
I see.
Yeah, so that was sort of like a geographical accident that brought the Gambino family hierarchy right to where I was. So it's like sort of an accident of fate that now the center of power is where I'm hanging out. And I know all the guys that are around.
Because that's where like most of their sort of centers were. The clubhouses were in that neighborhood.
That's correct. Like, so once a week, all of the captains throughout the boroughs in Long Island had to trek to Queens now to pay homage to Gotti once a week.
Right.
You'd be driving in Ozone Park. I think it was a Wednesday night. I forget when John used to have dinners and stuff at the club in Ozone Park. He also had the Ravenite, which was in Manhattan, which was another one of his clubs that he took over from the former underboss of the Gambino crime family, Neil Delacroche. And I'm very close with guys who were in Delacroche's family to this day. I saw them in Staten Island a few months ago. John Gotti's oldest brother was Peter Gotti. I was in and out of his house for the better part of like 6 or 7 years. Every day.
Right. And you're still close with and have correspondence and relationships with plenty of guys who are still involved in that life and were.
Quite a few. When I was in Staten Island and back in November, I bumped into a lot of guys. You know, I said hello and goodbye to them. I keep it moving because there's not as much in common anymore.
Sure.
Yeah. But they still, look, they have a great deal of respect for me still because I never ratted.
Right.
I never snitched. Even the things I talk about, if I'm talking about my own crimes, they're 30 years old. The statute's long gone. And I still don't use the right names if they're alive and active.
And they appreciate your honesty and discretion at the same time and upholding your standards, so to speak.
They do. They're proud of me. I hosted a show for Discovery Channel. I had guys who said, I watched your shows. They were great. You know, he's an active guy to this day. He's
yeah,
a captain.
That's amazing.
And
It's really interesting.
Yeah.
And it also dispels some myths that I think that people have about how people look at some things in that life.
Yeah. Nowadays, there are so many rats since the advent of ratting, which started kind of with Sammy the Bull Gravano. You know, Joe Valachi might have ratted back in the 60s.
Right. Or Abe Twist, Ray Lace, who's in the book also.
Exactly.
He was sort of like the founder of the whole idea that someone can bring a whole borgata down.
That's right. Yeah. Abe Relis, that's right. But they were like far and few in between. You know, they'd go years without ratting again. It was a big deal if they dug somebody up. Now, the FBI had a covert operation. They had what they called top echelon informants who were giving them secret information, the FBI did, since the 60s. But as far as like an out-and-out rat who took the stand against people, far and few. Like you said, Abe Relis, Ovalachi was another one. And then once Sammy ratted, a lot of guys followed this trend and they all would go into the prosecutor's office and say, give me a deal like Sammy did, knowing he got 5 years for 19 murders. They figured, I only have 6 murders. Yeah. I should only do 3 years.
That sets a big precedent, doesn't it?
It does. And, you know, little Al Diaco, Gaspipe Casso, they all started to follow. So now you have all these rats. The mob was thrilled to have somebody like me say to them, while I was inside, I said it. I approached the underbosses, the bosses while I was inside, the guys who were active, who I was locked up with. And I said, look, if I got to leave here in a pine box, I'm facing life. I'll get back to my cases, which I haven't finished with you yet, too.
Sure.
If I have to serve life, no big deal. I made this commitment and I'm going to live by it. If I got to drop dead in this place at 100, hopefully, or hopefully I die younger, actually, if I got to serve life.
Right.
If I got to leave here in a pine box, so be it. But if I ever get out, and at the time I was facing life, I just want to be left alone. So with all the rats, how do you say to a guy, no? You know, I'm upholding omerta. I'm not ratting on anybody. I never will. And I'm telling you that. All I'm asking is that I'm let loose. I don't want to be bothered. Let me go my way. Let bygones be bygones. See you later. Hasta la vista. Ashante.
Sure.
So that's basically what I did and why they say nowadays, sure, go. You know, John Gotti Jr. left the life. He was an acting boss at one time, if not official.
Right.
And he left the life.
I didn't realize that, really. Wow.
Yeah. I mean, he's not taking a stand against anybody. There's no reason to kill him. You know, they have a different outlook today. And I think it came from this flood of informants. Little Vicarina is another perfect example. Little Vicarina was the boss of the Colombo family, the acting boss in the 90s throughout the Colombo War. His son was a captain, Capo. Dear friend of mine to this day. We're dear friends for 30, 35 years. And he's a sweetheart of a guy. Absolute brilliant guy. The life didn't deserve him. He got sucked in because of his father was involved in the life, and he was much more intelligent, could have done anything with his life, but eventually realized when he beat a murder RICO indictment, he was lucky enough, fortunate enough to beat that case. He should go on his own and leave the life, and he did. So he's another perfect example where he said, I'm done. I'm retiring. I don't want to be bothered with this anymore. I gave years of my life to it, and he ended up serving 10 years for other charges. But when he got out, he said, I'm done. And they let him go. You know, what are we going to do? Chase him around? He's an honorable man. He could have ratted on a million guys. He could have took down the Colombo family with everybody that he could have put away. He refused to do that. He was a man of men. So it's hard to argue with him if he wants to just be left alone. So that's sort of the new attitude they have now. And I'm lucky to be part of that sort of new trend. Maybe back in the 60s or 70s, they would have said, no, you're not allowed. You know, till death do us part, and you got to die. You're not going to write a book about this, even if it's a book that doesn't hurt anybody. You're not allowed.
Right.
But it's different now.
It's like they came to their senses about how being this hard line about this kind of thing is more hazardous than it is helpful.
Absolutely. Good way to put it. They did come to their senses, and, you know, they acclimate. The mob, their adaptability is incredible.
Yeah.
You know, they adapt to situations. They adapt to profitable enterprises if one presents itself. I said when Prohibition came around, they bootlegged. When the stock market crashed, they were flush with cash from bootlegging. They lent out cash and they asked for a piece of everyone's business. They were always reactive to whatever was going on in the United States. When people couldn't gamble at casinos and people wanted to gamble, they opened up casinos or they provided them with bookmakers. You can't always make it to the racetrack. I grew up in the OTB, off-track betting in New York, and Aqueduct. I used to go with my father from when I was a kid. I wish I went to a library back then. I didn't. I used to hang out in the OTB with all old guys smoking, chewing on old cigars, soggy cigars. Before that, you know, they had a bookmaker you could call up from the comfort of your own home and just put a bet in. You know, I want to bet the fourth and fifth race at Aqueduct. I want to bet the sixth race at Belmont. I want to bet the football game. I want to bet the hockey game. I want to bet the baseball game. You had bookmakers, mob guys for this. So they were always reactive and adaptive. Getting back to how I faced life. So with all the charges, all the cases I had against me. Yeah, I mean, I was facing the rest of my life in prison. The armed robbery case alone, each time I was charged with the commission of a crime, which was a violent felony, I faced 10 years for each crime, each count in the indictment that was one crime.
Wow. So they were stacking charges against you. And I mean, like you said, you had several agencies sort of fighting over you or clamoring to get you kind of a trophy.
Fighting over me and clamoring over me, and at the same time working in concert to pressure me and flip me. They wanted to flip
me. Ah, wow.
Yeah, when you get three indictments, and then I had an addendum to one of the indictments, new charges that was attached to one of the indictments. So it's almost like four indictments at one point.
So they were really trying to scare you into flipping and rolling over.
That's what they want to do. Yeah, so they knew. If you looked at just my telephone toll records, you know that I'm back and forth speaking to the Gotti houses on a regular basis. Then I used to stay in Chin Giganti's house. I was friends with the family, not necessarily close with Chin himself, but with his family.
Sure.
So then my phone records are going back and forth to the Chin's house. You know, they're just looking at me and they know now I'm involved with all these heists and hijackings. They see my phone records going back to the Gottis and the Gigantes, who were the bosses of the Genovese family Chin was.
Right.
And the Gambino family Gotti was. So I'm like, possibly I'm the missing link. If I cooperate, who can I give up? You know, he must know a lot.
Those families were kind of in a Cold War period. There was a lot of animosity there.
They were. And when Chin found out that I was, you know, I'd stay at his house on the weekends, Rita Giganti, who was Chin's daughter, youngest daughter, she's still my friend, again, 35 years later.
Yeah, I've actually seen an interview with her with Mark Leiter. It's a very interesting person.
She is an extremely interesting person and an absolute doll, my old way of saying it, right?
Sure.
Old language. An absolute sweetheart, a beautiful person. She's got a heart of gold. She was there for me throughout my bid, as was Chin's wife, Olympia. They stuck by me.
Wow.
But at some point when Chin heard that I was in his house, he's got a Gambino family mobster sleeping over his house on the weekends. You know, Chin lived in the city in Greenwich Village in his mother's apartment. He lived with his 90-year-old mother.
Right.
And he ran the Genovese family throughout the country and the world from that little beat-down old flat in Greenwich Village.
Yeah, in between walks, showing off that he was crazy and in his house robe. Exactly. Stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, he played this loony role
right.
for the better part of 30 years.
Pretty masterfully, you have to say.
Absolute genius. The guy was brilliant. He fooled the best doctors. Some of them were bribed, obviously, but a lot of them he fooled. Government doctors he fooled. His own he may have bribed. Yeah, absolute brilliant. Dramatic, worthy of an Academy Award.
Yeah.
You know, he'd walk the street in a bathrobe and pajamas and talk to parking meters, you know, knowing he was under surveillance. Incredible.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing.
Yeah. So when his family, though, the family that bore his name, his real family, he had a second family as well in Manhattan.
Oh.
But the legitimate family that bore his name, Giganti, they lived in a beautiful house in Old Tappan, which was just over the George Washington Bridge, up the Palisades, a short distance.
Right.
And they had a beautiful house there, and that's where I used to stay. So when he found out that, again, being mobster is living in his house on the weekends, he went berserk. He called Rita down to the city and he said, get this guy out of my house. And Rita had his coulions. She was tough. And she said, look, you pick your friends, I'll pick mine.
Wow.
I ain't giving him up. He's my friend. Yeah. So, you know, when she told me, I said, Ree, I love you, Ree. I said, you know, Rita, short for Rita. I said, Ree, I love you, but he's going to clip me, not you.
Right.
So I started keeping an eye out when I went back and forth to the house.
I bet.
Obviously. Yeah. So, you know, because him and John had a feud. What happened was when, just to go back, though, everyone understands, when John took over the family and killed Castellano, he did it with only partial permission from the commission.
Right.
He got the families that sat on the commission. The commission is a sort of a round table. Each of the five families gets a seat. So he approached the ones who he knew he was close enough to and would give him the nod and say, go ahead. But he skipped over Chin, knowing Chin had a strong relationship with Castellano.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, and very strong business ties with Castellano. They had multi-million dollar construction enterprises together. So Chin wasn't going to just say, yeah, sure, kill Paul. No, not happening.
Right.
So he skipped over Chin, figuring I'll deal with Chin later. And Chin immediately said, someone's going to have to pay for this at some point in time. You can't just kill a boss without permission.
Right.
So Chin then began to maneuver behind the scenes to have John killed. At some point or another, one of Chin's hit crews got caught on tape planning to kill John Gotti. And at another time, they blew up a car that they believed John Gotti was in, and it turned out to be John Gotti's underboss, Frankie DiCicco.
That was kind of a big deal, because that was unheard of at the time to use bombs like that, right?
Which is the reason they did it. So they didn't want John's family, because John was supposed to be killed by the blast, but they didn't want John's family to know that it was them. They just wanted to remove John from the scene. So they wanted everybody to think that there was what they called, the slang for it was the zip wing. ZIP.
Right, people from Italy?
From the other side, yeah.
Yeah.
So the Gambino family had a strong Sicilian-American faction within the Gambino crime family. A lot of them were related to the Castellanos and Gambinos at the time. And in Sicily, they used explosives back then. They blew up judges.
Right.
They thought nothing of using explosives in Sicily.
The famous Falcone, I believe, was his name, the prosecutor.
That's right.
Yeah, his whole family.
Yeah, that's right. They killed Falcone. That's right. So they thought nothing of, they'd blow up a whole block to get one guy in Sicily. But in the United States, we knew, the mafia did, that if you blow up people, there's going to be a lot of repercussions. We don't have the same attitude in Sicily. The public is not going to accept it, and the public's going to put pressure on law enforcement. Law enforcement is going to decimate the mafia.
Right.
There's no telling. A bomb kills indiscriminately. So you
right.
don't know if you're going to kill a little girl. Could be a little girl walking, you know, selling Girl Scout cookies, walking by a car as it blows up, and it's not good press.
Sure.
So we don't do it yet. But they said the guys that were involved in this, Chin wasn't actually privy to the bomb part because Chin was working in concert with the Lucchese family, and Gaspipe was in charge of the plot for the Lucchese family, Gaspipe Casso.
I see, yeah.
So he was the one who said, look, let's use a bomb and we'll throw the scent off ourselves. They'll think it was the Sicilian-American faction within the Gambino crime family that was responding to Paul's murder, Paul Castellano.
Right.
And then that's the best way to not create some type of blood feud where we get into like an internal war here in New York, because if it's the zip wing of the family, they're back in Sicily. What are you going to do? They came here, planted the bomb and left. You know, we're not going to go start turning Sicily upside down. If we land in Palermo, they'll kill us.
Right.
That was the goal. But anyway, Chin was somehow behind it. He didn't have direct knowledge that it was going to be a bomb. He wouldn't have approved of that. Getting back to the feud, he wants me out of the house. So Rita, I knew at the time, Rita was one of my best friends, so obviously I know she's gay. Rita is a lesbian.
Sure.
So I said, tell your father you're a lesbian. At least he knows there's not a hood from the Gambino family fooling around with his daughter. Let him know at least that. She goes,
right.
I told him already. She said, he's old school. He said, it's just a phase I'm going through. I'll get through it. So I go, you got to be kidding me. Explain to him it's not a phase. It's you're born with it. Tell him. So she goes, no. He can't understand that. Well, at least tell him, you know, my language back then. At least tell him I'm not banging you. You know, I wanted him to know. I wanted him to know that your daughter's a lesbian. At least Louis Ferrante isn't fooling around with her. You
right.
know, at least, you know, if he's going to order a hit, let it be for the right reasons.
Right.
But anyway, we had a big laugh over that. Please tell him you're a lesbian. And she's saying, I did, but he doesn't believe me. He's old school Italian. He said, I'll outgrow it. So it was kind of funny. Whatever the case, to this day, I love her. She's a doll. She's a beautiful person. And that was basically my involvement in the feud. I had no involvement beyond that. This was
yeah.
at the top between John and Chin. You know, I'm at the bottom. I'm running a heist and hijacking crew, although I'm obviously connected to the biggest people in my family. Yeah, I'm not making big decisions like that, and I'm not involved in the feud. It was just my involvement as far as I'm in the Gotti's house during the week, and I'm in the Gigante's house on the weekend, and that's how I got sucked into this as being part of what the hell's he doing in my house.
Right.
You know, I'm looking to kill John Gotti, and John Gotti's got a guy in my house. This is crazy.
From the perspective of the agencies that are after you, what a goldmine, though, of your association. Put an even bigger
that.
Target
yeah.
on your back, right? And that's how these
yeah.
charges got so blown up, as
yeah.
opposed to someone who can get away with all these murders and then roll
yeah.
over on someone and spend hardly any time at all. They're sending you away for life.
Yeah, yeah.
And they didn't have you for any murder at all. Hijacking's a violent crime, but you weren't killing people, but they'll still send you away for life to try to make you roll over.
Matt, you're right, 100% right. And we did everything we could to avoid loss of life. I thank God we never accidentally killed someone.
Sure.
I thank God I was never killed and none of the guys I worked with were ever killed. But more importantly, that no one innocent was ever killed.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, that's something that would have killed me for the rest of my life.
Sure.
I might have just sank into a tub and opened my veins one day if that was the case. I lived with enough guilt. I didn't need that over my head.
Right.
So thank God. But having said that, going back to the prison experience, so I'm facing life because let's say there's 10 counts. Each count carries a 10-year statute. So that's 100 years. And then each time a gun is used in the commission of a crime at the time, I'm not sure if the law still exists this way, but it was another 5 years. So there would be 100 for the crimes and another 50 for the gun each time a gun was used for the crimes. So I was facing, let's say, 150 years.
Wow.
That's how I faced life. Do you get that? Just so your listeners understand. If you try the government, if you say, I'm innocent, I'm going to tie up a prosecutor and a courtroom and a judge for 2 months and make you prove this at trial. If they do prove it at trial and the jury comes back with a guilty verdict, you will get the 150 years. I was in Metropolitan Detention Center for 3 years me and my co-defendants fighting our cases. Mm-hmm. And I cannot begin to tell you how many people with cases similar to my own left court, came back to the detention center and literally cried on my shoulder because they were sentenced to 125 years, 180 years, 220 years. So they got those times. You know, I have a friend of mine.
Because they tried to fight the case or try to go with the innocent plea.
Yeah, and the government wants to make a point that if you're going to waste our time, if everybody went to trial, there are so many cases that the U.S. government brings against people on a daily basis.
Right.
That if everybody decided to take the government to trial, the system would grind to a halt. They are able to prosecute and incarcerate so many people because most people do take the plea.
Right.
If you're facing 150 years and they offer you 15, you know, you weigh it out and you eventually come to terms with it. And usually a lot of people who are even innocent took pleas. I know.
Something like 90% of cases are settled, plea bargained, or yeah.
Exactly. 90 something percent. And the reason being is because if you're sitting in that holdover, that detention center, and you see enough people crying on your shoulder because they got the big numbers, you call your lawyer and you say, get me the best plea you could get me. I'll take it. And it doesn't matter. As I said, in my own case, I was guilty. Some of the crimes I wasn't guilty of, but I was guilty of even more crimes that they didn't charge me with. So I knew I was a guilty person.
Right.
So, you know, hey, look, I'm guilty. Don't challenge the government. They're going to torture you and put you away for the rest of your life and put your lights out. So I faced that. So at some point or another, I got 5 years for that credit card case. And then the federal FBI case was next. We weren't getting any offers. They were saying, if you want to take 20 years, you could take 20, but that's it, meaning me. And then I was considered the mastermind, quote unquote mastermind. I was far from a mastermind.
Right.
But the mastermind is usually the guy who puts the heist together and masterminds the heist, right?
Yeah.
So I guess maybe in the world of heist, I was considered. Maybe I don't want to sell myself short. Maybe I was a mastermind.
Well, you were the networker, the organizer. Oh, you put things together. The people person, so to speak.
Exactly.
Making moves.
Yeah, that's right. But I was ignorant in a million other ways. So that's why I said it's an overblown title for me. If you weighed my other levels of intelligence, I was lacking in so many other ways.
You were a very young guy at the time also.
Yeah, and wild. So yeah. Yes, I mean, I had a lot to learn, a lot of maturity to go through, definitely. So they would say, the government would say, if you take 20 years, we'll give your co-defendants a little less, but those were the pleas they were offering. At one point, they might've been offering us all 20 years. We wouldn't take it. And then at some point, the government came and through our attorneys and they said, look, if Ferrante takes 13 years, and I think it was, they were willing to give me like 7 or 8 and then stack it with the 5. So it was going to be 13 consecutive.
Right.
We'll give the rest of his co-defendants less time, you know, 9, 8, 7, 6 down the road in matter of importance. So I said, look, what do you guys want to do? I said, well, let's take it, they said. So I said, okay, fine. They wanted us to do a global play. Everybody takes it. So I said, fine, I'll take the 13. Everybody gets less. We saved our own lives. So I take the play. I eventually went to prison and I met somebody who was a legal. At that time, by then, I was reading 18 hours a day. I picked up my first book. I had never read a book in my life. I was literate. I graduated high school, never went to college, but I did graduate high school. I was literate, but I never read a book in my life. If there was a book report, I cheated.
Yeah.
Not happening.
This is an interesting fact about you I find fascinating, is that you fell into it. Like, it's so natural for you to be an avid reader, and what led you to do what you do now is fascinating to me, that you had to go to prison to find that.
It's so true. At one point or another, I used to lay in my cell after I went through all the regret, the deep regret,
right,
and found books and then was reading 18 hours a day. You know, I came to the realization that there was a God at some point. And I would literally thank God and say, thank you, God Almighty, for putting me here. And that's a crazy thing to say in this hell, but I found something I loved, and I couldn't have imagined, had I lived my life without going through that experience, I would have lived a half a life. Throughout my life, I probably would have been carrying around the lighter chains of ignorance, but not necessarily being trapped in a prison cell, but you just walk around ignorance until eventually I would have probably got life or been killed.
So in some ways, prison kind of saved your life in more than one way.
Saved my life, absolutely. And it's because I had the wherewithal to pick up a book, because I attribute none of this to the prison system.
Sure.
By the grace of God, I woke up, picked up books, started reading, fell in love with books, began to educate myself, and realized there was a different world out there, and started to think deeply about the things I had done and what the world was about and how we should live and how I should live. But that all came by myself. But if we gave incentives to prisoners to read, even if they read just to get an extra piece of chocolate cake on Friday night,
sure.
Give them some ridiculous incentive as if they were children, that's fine with me. But if they read enough books and they get through enough schooling, they have incentives to educate themselves, maybe, just maybe, when they're prepared to wake up for one reason or another, when they've had enough of the hell they've been through all their lives, when they're ready to change, they'll have a better understanding and they'll be more equipped to make that change. Whereas if you don't educate people and you just lock them up for 5-10 years and let them back out, they haven't learned anything, you haven't taught them anything, and they have no real options.
Right.
You know, it's either work in a gas station or stick up a gas station. What are they going to do?
Hence the recidivism rate that you mentioned earlier.
Exactly. So shame on us for having control of someone's life for so many years and doing nothing to try to better that life. Shame on us for that. As a society, as a country, and shame on us, meaning myself as well. I've tried, and I'm sure there are plenty of people out there who have tried, but collectively speaking, as a society, shame on us that we haven't done something better to repair that. But anyway.
Absolutely. I agree with you. Yeah.
Yeah. That aside, eventually learned law, and I realized that there were technicalities in my plea agreement. Actually, the appellate court notified me at some point through a letter. My attorney filed something immediately after the sentencing saying that there were no appellate issues and we waive our right to appeal. And the appellate court shot back a letter saying, you should look closely. So obviously there was. So I immediately fired the attorney and I filed briefs pro se. And I learned law through this friend of mine. His name is Marcos Pappas, a brilliant legal eagle. He's back in prison, unfortunately. He's a perfect example. He got out after 20-something years. I stuck with him throughout that entire time from when I left to when he got home. I'd send him commissary. I would always write him and I helped his mother while she was alive. And then he gets out of prison after doing 20-something years. He's half Greek, half African-American from Connecticut. And he gets out of prison after 22 years.
And he has a great legal mind, intelligent person?
Absolutely brilliant. I mean, he's the guy who really taught me law, you know, and helped me. And this is how you read law. I mean, helped me file my briefs as well. And then I went on to, once I learned law, I filed briefs for, I don't know how many people in there. I helped a lot of people myself too. You know, I became a sort of like prison attorney myself, but it all started with him.
I'm sure those skills are sought after.
Yeah. And it, you know, once people find out, you reverse the case too.
Oh yeah.
And it all started with him though. To give you an idea how brokenhearted I've been recently, he gets out of prison after all those years and he's out a couple of years and he's back in already, you know, for a whole array of different charges.
Oh, wow.
And I'm absolutely brokenhearted because we were talking regularly and I'm not sure what was wrong because he was an absolute brilliant man. So I'm yet to talk to him again. I love him. I will reach out to him. He's like a brother of mine, but I'm still just going through the shock of, you know, I'm not prepared yet, I guess, to speak to him because I'm devastated,
yeah.
You know, that I stuck with him all these years and he's back. And it just broke my heart. You know, I gave him the speech I give everybody when they get out. I don't care if you have to live in a cardboard box and beg for money on the street, play an instrument that you can't even play with a cup out. Don't commit a crime and they can't send you back. Don't commit a crime. I would tell that to everybody. No matter how bad it gets, there's a God. And if God sees that you're honest and you really, really want to make strides, God will help you eventually. He'll send help. If you live in a cardboard box, that box will turn into a shack. That shack will turn into a one-bedroom apartment. The one-bedroom apartment will eventually turn into a house. But it takes time. Don't give in. So I would always say that to everybody. And I told that to Marcos as well. And it breaks my heart to know he's back. But again, we need to help prisoners when they're locked up.
Absolutely.
And we need to give them incentive. Getting back, I reversed one of my cases, the plea, on a technicality, not because I was innocent. I went back to the district court. It was reversed by the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. By briefs, I filed personally, pro se, with the help of Marcos, which was great. And then I eventually learned how to file my own briefs and how to read case law and how to cite case law. And now my own case law stands in the courts throughout the country. It's cited regularly because I made case law at that point. But it was reversed. I went back, I pleaded not guilty, and I learned that the witness against us who had gone into the witness protection program, he had violated the program in one way or another, probably committed more crimes.
Sure.
We go back to if you inform, you don't reform.
Exactly. It happens quite a bit. It's a good turn of phrase because it's so accurate.
Yeah. So he goes back to prison. I believe he went back to prison, but I know he violated the program. And because of that, they had thrown him out of the program. So when we took the pleas, they never had a rat against us. They never had an informant. He was the main informant against us. So as I understood it, they probably had other little ancillary things, witnesses and evidence, but there was really no main witness. He was the guy. So they never had a case. So at that point, I said, I want to go to trial when I realized that. And I asked for a speedy trial and then I forced the government to dismiss that case. So that's how I was able to get out in 8.5 years.
Wow. That's amazing.
And in that 8.5 years, I did nothing but educate myself. So it was the education that I desperately needed. I did state time too. I ended up doing 2 years in the state, which was another hellhole in itself, but we do nothing for people in the state either. But anyway, that's how it sort of happened.
It's sad also because it's often overlooked and not talked about the way that it should be, because I think that we culturally are trained into looking the other way. Like, well, they're criminals anyway, sort of giving up on people. And that's a sad way of looking at it.
I agree, because if they return the same way, it's just an extra burden on us. Do we need the burden again as a society? So we kind of like punish ourselves as well.
It's a bad, pervasive, I think, attitude in American culture of being willing to leave people behind. Mm-hmm. Ironically, so against what the military in this country is all about, leave no soldier behind. But then in society, there's a willingness to do that. It's amazing, and I really commend you for taking agency of your life and making that difference and then winning and getting out and obviously doing what you're doing now. I think it's really impressive and inspiring, and I'm sure especially to people who know you, knew you, were incarcerated also.
Thank you.
And you said you found religion in prison, or you found God. You converted to Judaism, is that correct?
I did. I came to the realization through reading philosophy, science, law.
Right. And throughout your many references and extensive bibliography in the book, it's clear that you really did cover so many bases in what you chose to read.
I did. Yeah. Thank you. I'm glad you noticed that. Thank you.
Yeah.
So through all of the study, I started to understand the world a lot better than I'd ever understood it. I was isolated in the subculture that I lived in, the mafia subculture.
Right.
That was my whole life. You know, my circle of friends, and I have a very strict code, the code of a Cosa Nostra, that we abide by, we live by. It's not the laws of society. It's not any type of moral laws. My mother did teach me morals when I was young, but she died in my arms when she was 47 years old. I was 19, 20 years old. She died in my arms. It broke my heart, and anything she had taught me, if there were any morals, I felt like if there was a God, that it was an evil God. How do you let tumors the size of softballs and cantaloupes grow out of my mother's head? She looked like the Elephant Man.
Oh, man.
When she died. Yeah, and it just didn't...
That's so hard and terrible. Jeez.
Oh, it was horrible, and it didn't make sense to me. And if there was a God, it was an evil God. That's what I thought throughout my criminal career. And then I'm in prison, and I'm starting to feel this regret, deep regret for what I did. And I said, my mother didn't raise me like this. And you could still honor your mother's soul by the way you live.
Yeah.
Or how do you say it? Like taint it.
Sure.
And I made the wrong choices. I was doing the wrong things. So I start to realize there is a God. And my mother always taught me there was a God when I was a kid. She would even say long before she ever got sick, if one day, you know, I'm not here or me and your father aren't here, remember there's always a God. I remember that, her saying that all the time. So now I'm in a prison cell and I'm realizing, okay, there must be a God because I'm being punished. So I understand that. I'm being punished for the things I did. And the punishment sounds just, feels just, because I did horrible things. And now I'm in a prison cell, which is exactly where I belong. Unlike, I said, the snitches who don't think they belong there. I belong. I realized I belong there.
Right.
I did these things. I have no right to stick a gun to somebody. This isn't something that anyone has a right to do to another human being.
Began facing those hard truths that come in life.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, you know, what would John Stuart Mill say about this, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, you're reading these people and Hobbes, what would Hobbes say about it,
right,
etc. So I'm going, okay, I deserve to be here. And the next thing is, though, the same God, I felt like a God was punishing me, or a higher power, a law, a justice, a higher justice. But the same law or higher power that was punishing me for these things was also rewarding me. I'm in a cell, but I'm reading. And now I fell in love with books. So I feel like, okay, I'm in a horrible place and I'm being punished. But at the same time, I'm being rewarded because as I make strides to change myself, I'm finding something like books and different subjects that I love. I love philosophy. I would have never picked up a book on philosophy, the ancient Greeks, the Enlightenment philosophers, you name it. I love the law. I'm studying the law. I didn't know anything about the law when they convicted me of all these crimes. They're throwing around Latin phrases in the courtroom. I'm going, what the hell are they talking about?
Right.
This is Chinese to me.
Right.
This is a different language. You know, now I'm studying the law and I'm learning the law. And now I'm studying science and physics and realizing that the sun rises and sets. I said, we were talking about the sun one time. I was explaining the sunrise and sunset to another convict who said to me, does the sun always set in the same place? Or does it set on the other side of the world once in a while? He's my age.
Yeah.
In his late 20s by then. And he's asking me such a rudimentary question. You could see that we're very, very lacking in education when we end up in these places.
Yeah.
One time somebody asked me what happened when Napoleon and Caesar fought. And I said, I don't know. They were 1800 years apart, these two guys.
Right.
1800 years. Wow, that's a long time. They don't understand. And nor did I when I first started reading and learning.
Sure.
So here I am, and I find all of these beautiful things like education and these subjects I'm learning about. And I'm realizing that the same higher power that punished me is also rewarding me at the same time. So there is something going on here. And this is a feeling I had inside. So I began with the monotheistic religions. I felt that there was one God. I was taught that there was one God, born into Catholicism.
Right.
There's
sure.
one God. And once again, before I even engage in this conversation, I have friends that are Catholic. I have family that is still Catholic. I have friends that are Christian. I have friends that are Islam. I have friends that adhere to Buddhism. You name it, I have friends, and I believe we're all right as long as it inspires us to do good. I just
sure.
want to preface the conversation with that.
Absolutely.
I don't want to insult anyone's religion or anyone's belief. God drops different types of breadcrumbs for all of us to bring us to him. And my breadcrumbs were the breadcrumbs of Judaism, and I'll get to that. So I started to study the monotheistic religions, believing in one God. And the monotheistic religions were Judaism, and then Christianity, and then Islam.
Sure.
In that order. And they all seem to use Judaism as the basis of their religions. I realized that when I read the Quran,
right,
there was a lot of things that I'd learned in Judaism.
There is that timeline, like you said, you listed it in order of the timeline of mm-hmm. their coming about.
Exactly, yeah. And you could see also, too, the different aspects of their religion, even Christianity. The Old Testament is verbatim the Torah.
Yeah.
That's the Old Testament. And then there's the New Testament. We added an addendum to this. So at some point I said, let me focus on the Torah, the Old Testament, and read that. And I read it and it spoke to me. And I read it over and over. And I had read the Bhagavad Gita. I read the Upanishads. I read the Quran, as I said. I read the Gospels. And now I'm reading the Torah and it speaks to me. And I did like the fact that there was laws surrounding to guide us.
Right.
The way we live life. That was something that spoke to me. I needed that.
It's very structured.
Very structured. So I, at some point I concluded, I said, you know what? If God supposedly picked the Jews and then Christianity and Islam could have come next, and maybe if you adhere to those religions, that's fine. But I could go right to the Jews. If he picked the Jews, I don't believe God makes mistakes. I'm fine with the Jews. I'm fine with the Torah. Look, if that's the first one, the origins of the monotheistic religions, I can't go wrong.
Yeah.
If Jesus and Muhammad were alive, could they argue I'm apparently going to the same God? God, the original God, that they would also, our Father who art in heaven is the Christian prayer. Who is our Father who art in heaven that Jesus is talking about? The God of the Jews. He was
it
a
is.
Jew.
Yeah, sure. They were riffing on what the Jews had already laid down.
Yeah, so I just cut to the quick and went straight to Judaism and figured that's my safe bet. It was like, go directly to the boss. Why bother with these guys on the lower levels? I went to the boss. So that's like my take on it. I did not convert to Judaism until I got home from jail, because I was smart enough to know that you'd become delusional in a prison cell. Guys think they could come home and become fighter pilots.
Right.
Because they want to be. You're not going to be a fighter pilot, buddy. The Air Force is very, very picky. They don't take, you know, you might come out of West Point, you know, not get on into fighter pilot school. You sure as hell ain't coming out of Lewisburg and getting onto fighter pilot school. People get delusional, and I feel bad for them when they do, but I didn't know if I was delusional in this sense.
Yeah.
Was I going to be an observant Jew when I got out of this hellhole? It's easy now to eat kosher when they're serving you crap all week anyway.
Right.
But am I going to eat kosher when I got an Italian restaurant on the corner that makes nice brajol and a sauce? And pig's feet, like my mother used to make, pig's yeah. knuckles, you know, in the sauce on Sunday. I don't know. Am I going to keep the Sabbath when there's a big party on Friday night and I want to go and I want to dance up a storm on a Friday night? Am I going to keep Shabbos and lock in? And
sure.
So I don't know. So I waited till I got home and I made sure that this was something I wanted to do. And that's when I officially converted when I got home.
Wow, that's really impressive. And there's a lot of foresight in that, knowing that similarly how we were talking about how people get out and then the same temptations are there. And it's so easy to fall back into. I mean, we're creatures of habit without a doubt. Out, we very naturally fall back into what we know. So to make sure that you get out and you're in an environment where you can uphold the things that you envision upholding as a practicing Jew, it's really interesting. And I think it's important to know your perspective in that regard when it comes to not just your time incarcerated and how you came to educate yourself, but also in the way that you wrote this book, because in this book also, it's very much about the cooperation between Jewish and Italian immigrants, right? Especially in the early days in America.
Mm-hmm.
And I've written a lot of questions down. And one of my questions was, racism and discrimination is as American as apple pie. And you speak about Sicily and the original country and Sicilian culture and the feudalism that propped up the frameworks that became Italian organized crime, La Cosa Nostra in America. But those leading up to what happened in New Orleans with the police chief Hennessy in the book, it's just the early part of the book. And this was really, I think, an important part of the history of the mafia in America that a lot of people don't know. A lot of people would say, oh, it all started in New York, of course. But it really started in New Orleans, and it had a lot to do with racism and discrimination.
It did.
Would you mind talking a little bit about that?
Sure. It was news to me when I began doing my research. I always thought, being a New York mob guy, and that's all I knew. From 13, when I started stealing cars for joyrides, until 33, when I got out of prison, it's 20 years of just criminal activity and the mob. All I know is the mob once I become a teenager. So I always thought that the hub of organized crime was always New York, because the Five Families was the biggest concentration of mafia criminals, mafiosos in the country.
Sure.
And remains to this day. It's sort of like the Rome of the Roman Empire.
Right.
Yeah. So there might be other places, Chicago, Detroit, but New York is the place where the mob really is,
right,
to me. And then I started doing my research and I understood that what happened was, after the unification of Italy in the 1860s and the abolition of slavery in the 1860s in the United States, those two things played a monumental role in the mafia's formation, in the sense that Italy proper, the peninsula, was trying to eject the French and Austrians that were in Italy.
Right.
Northern and Southern Italy. And Garibaldi was instrumental in doing that. The Sicilians, for their participation, they were promised independence. They said, look, you help us get rid of the Austrians and the French and you'll have independence. Italy and Sicily will be Sicily. And a lot of Sicilians were under the impression they would have independence. And after that, they did not get independence. They became part of Italy. And Sicily had so many different rulers throughout the centuries. And they just considered Italy proper another one of their latest overlords.
Right.
They had no respect for Italy. They didn't want to be Italians. And my grandmother would be the first to tell you, I'm not Italian, I'm Sicilian.
Right.
You know, where if I said, Nana, you're Italian, right? I'm not Italian, I'm Sicilian. So that's how Sicilians felt throughout this period. And then even the vote to supposedly include Sicily, there was sort of like a referendum at one point, and they supposedly voted to include themselves, the Sicilians did, into Italy proper. But a lot of the Sicilians said the vote was fixed. We never voted. This wasn't real. And throughout the decades following, it bears out that they were accurate because there was a lot of pushback in right. Sicily. We wanted to be Sicilians. So this dates back to the Roman Empire.
Right. There was many occupiers of Sicily over the centuries. It became commonplace for them.
Exactly. The French, the Arabs, there was tremendous Arab influence that I traced in the book to the founding fathers of the mafia in Sicily.
Right.
And I urge all of you readers to read it. The book is Borgata. But the Arab influence is extremely, to me, interesting. Struck me. I've had a lot of feedback from people saying that they were absolutely floored by my research in that regard and had no idea as well. But all the different conquerors in Sicily contributed to this sort of Sicilian way of thinking that we're on our own. We do things ourselves. And they were very, very family oriented. So after the unification of Italy, a lot of Southern Italians and Sicilians decide to emigrate. They want to leave. They want to get the hell out. And it's poor. Italy's poor too. And they're not getting anything right. It's a new government. And things are just like backwards. And at the same time, we abolished slavery here in the United States following the American Civil War. Now, because we don't have slave labor in the United States, the country is desperate for cheap labor to right. replace the slave. And they say, well, these Southern Italians, who were, by the way, considered by many Europeans as black, they were considered sort of like North Africans. And there was a lot of derogatory names in right. Europe attributed to them, that they were Africans. So now they're coming in droves, these immigrant waves, into the United States, and they're taking the cheapest, worst jobs that were once fueled by slave labor. A lot of these Southern plantations now who are deprived of slave labor, they're going, all right, we'll hire the Sicilians for dirt a day.
Right.
They'll work for nothing. So they start hiring these Sicilians, and a lot of them migrated to New Orleans, and there's several reasons for that. One is they were attracted to the Mediterranean-style climate. You leave in the Mediterranean. Do you really want to go to New York where there's 9 feet of snow
right.
during the winter? Not really.
That's a stark change, yeah.
Oh, my. Yeah, it's like picking me up and throwing me in Siberia or Alaska tomorrow or at the poles, the North or South Pole. They're sort of like flocking to Louisiana for the climate and also for the labor. A lot of these plantations and estates need work.
Right.
Workers. So they go in there and they work the docks, they work the plantations, and they end up also becoming very close with the blacks because the Italian immigrants, a lot of the whites, after the slaves were freed, they didn't want to live with the blacks. They didn't want to live in the same quarters with the blacks, you know, the black quarter, and hobnob with the blacks and go to the same restaurants at the blacks. But the Southern Italians were like, no problem.
Right.
We got no problem with the blacks. So they sort of immediately took to the blacks. There's a lot of stuff on TV nowadays that makes me sick. They try to paint Italians as racist. If any racism came about, it's when blacks and Italians shared close-knit neighborhoods in the 60s and 70s during the civil rights movement. There was a lot of friction for other reasons. We could get into that. That's a whole other story.
Sure.
Where there would be an incident between an Italian kid and a black kid or something. But the Italians were known to be the least. They exhibited no racism. In the beginning, they were happy to not only live with the blacks, but work alongside them and vote at the ballot box for anything that benefited the blacks. There's tremendous evidence on this, too. And I was like, oh, wow. It was refreshing for me, for my own ancestry, to know that.
Sure. It's almost a testament to how much American culture ingrains that. The more American Italians got, the more racial friction might have occurred because the more American you are, maybe the more that's ingrained in you in some way.
Exactly. And when Italians first landed here, my ancestors were considered black. We were called pizza ends.
Right.
We were called ends turned inside out. We were given all of these horrible derogatory names.
Yeah, there's several that you list in the book. Yeah, terrible.
Yeah. Besides the usual ones we know, wop, Greaseball, Guinea,
right.
or Greasa, the typical ones we know. There was a lot of other ones that were horrible. Again, evidence. I found newspaper clippings, newspaper articles, where they called us these things in the newspapers. This was incredible to me. So the next thing that I learned was, next to blacks, the Italians were the most lynched race in the South.
Yeah, that was a shocking part of what you wrote in the book to me. And, you know, there's some disturbing images being from the South myself. It's a bitter pill to swallow, knowing that that was such a big part of the history in this area. And the fact that lynch mobs were made specifically for Italians was shocking.
Yeah. So the next largest group to be lynched, and also victims of the largest mass lynching in history, which is what happens in New Orleans.
Right.
Yeah. The Italians flock there for work. There's a trend. The mafiosos who flee Sicily and eventually other parts of southern Italy, like Naples and Calabria, etc., they end up, let's say, where the big Italian workforces are. So where the Italian labor movement goes in America, the mafiosos follow because they want to be around their own kind. It's harder to extort. I mean, how are you going to extort an Englishman or an Irishman or a German when you can't even speak their language? They're going to go, get out of here, WAP. We'll call the police on you.
Right.
You know, it's easier to embed yourselves in the Italian neighborhoods, these mafiosos. So they sort of went where the workforce went. And then they had this really, really ideal way of organizing the workforces. So for example, if Italian labor dominated the waterfront in New Orleans, which they did, then the Italian mafiosos need only come in and organize the Italian labor and then now get what they want. We could shut down the docks in 5 minutes if we want. We could shut down then the fruit and vegetable market.
Right.
The vegetables that come in through the waterfront from South and Central America or from Europe, you're not going to get them. We'll squeeze this industry overnight. Fruits and vegetables are perishable and we don't have to stop it for long to wipe you out.
Right.
So they had now control over other markets, and they learned how to embed themselves in these things. Whatever union it would have been, they would have either formed the union or infiltrated the union. And it's incredible. If you follow it in my book, Borgata, Rise of Empire, which is the first volume, you see how they sort of inserted themselves into these different aspects of socioeconomic portions of American society throughout the country. One was in New Orleans. So when the police chief who inserted himself in mafia business in New Orleans was killed, probably by the mob, but a lot of innocent Italians were thrown on the indictment because they needed to lock up Italians quick. And when they were acquitted by a court, no Italians on the jury, by the way, 12 jurors, non-Italians acquitted them. The populace went bananas. They said, no way. We want justice.
And wasn't it in part to them just rounding people up aimlessly? They weren't really even concerned whether they were guilty or not. They tried to pick people who looked like easy marks. Maybe some of them were, but a lot of them weren't.
Yes. Anybody they saw, they were just picking up Italians. If you couldn't attest for your whereabouts when the police chief was shot, you were getting thrown in a paddy wagon. If you couldn't speak English, you were getting thrown in a paddy wagon. If you had a gun, even if it was a gun that was legal or a gun for protection and had nothing to do with the chief's murder, you were getting thrown in a paddy wagon. Little kids were beat up, grown men, old men. They invaded houses. They locked up everybody. And eventually, in the end, they weaned the indictment down to a dozen or so guys. A couple of them were mob guys. Most of them weren't. But these guys were tried. They were acquitted across the board. And interestingly, the mob guys are the ones the judge threw out the case for.
Right.
Yeah. So it seems like the real mob guys were able to get a back channel to the judge. That, in my opinion, they were able to bribe somebody because the judge threw out the case on the real mob guys and leaves these, we would say in Italian, these scimunides, these poor souls, these machinists to rot. And those are the guys who ended up being acquitted as well, though. So they're acquitted, and the public says, hell no, you're not going to kill our police chief and get away with it. We'll take justice into our own hands. They literally take out an ad in the newspaper and tell everyone to meet at the Clay statue, which was the statue in honor of Henry Clay, known as the Great Compromiser on the eve of Civil War in America.
Right.
Tried to stop it. Yeah. I read a biography on him years ago. He was an incredible man. So they met at the Clay statue and they ended up saying, let's march to the prison where they were being held and let's storm the prison and blow their brains out. And that's exactly what they did. And they shot all of these Italians and they killed them indiscriminately. They hung them. They shot them hanging from posts. There were women there. There were children there. The children pelted the bodies with stones. The women watched with opera glasses from windows and rooftops. So the whole community went absolutely berserk. They lynched all these poor souls and they blamed it on the mafia.
Right.
They said the mafia killed the chief. So that's sort of the mafia's introduction to America in New Orleans. And this mass lynching is something that comes from the mafia's control. And I made a pretty good argument at the end of these chapters that there's a lot of belief that the community was tired of Italian labor And the Italian labor machine was incredible. Supposedly, from the testimonies that I read, they worked harder than anybody. Just like I don't see anybody, I'll be honest with you. I don't take a stance one way or the other. I don't want to make any political stances here on the immigration problem that's currently taking place in America.
Sure.
But I will say that Mexican Americans work extremely hard, and I don't see anybody working as hard as them in my community.
Right.
So the Italian Americans at that time were the same as the Mexican Americans are today who want to work.
And that can put a target on your back, whether they're white Americans or whatever other Americans that feel intimidated by that.
Exactly. And that's supposedly it was to right the economic imbalance in New Orleans. That's what this was done to. They said, we're going to straighten these Italians out once and for all. We're going to push them back down because they're moving up too rapidly. We don't want them controlling the waterfront. We don't want them controlling the fruit and vegetable market. It was called the French market, but it was completely taken over by Sicilians. We don't want them controlling the cotton market. They're taking over everything. And we've got to show them, just like we lynch blacks now and then, lynch a few blacks, show the blacks where they are in the social economic structure, put them back in their place. Well, we'll do the same to the Italians. There's one big theory, and a lot of people have adhered to that. And I believe it to some extent myself that that's what happened. And by the way, getting back to the immigrant problem in America, just to be clear.
Sure.
Just as mafiosos came with the hardworking Sicilians who came, the same way we get bad with the people who just want to work hard here now. And obviously, there's a distinction between legal and illegal immigration. That's obvious.
Of course.
But I'm just saying, when you get a wave of people coming to your country, it's always the same throughout history. You get gang members today, and you get mafiosos back then, there's a couple of bad apples in the bushel. You're always going to get that. That's just what happens in life. And that's how the mafiosos rode in with the Sicilian / Southern Italian immigrant wave. And that's what happens today.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, that's just unfortunate, but it's just the way it works. Anyway, this was, I believe, a correction in New Orleans where they wanted to straighten them out and let them know where they stood in society. I put actually pictures of Italians being lynched.
Yeah.
In case anybody says, come on, you know, this didn't happen. No way.
No, there's a very disturbing image in the book.
Yeah.
It really hits home. And like I said, as a young person growing up in the South myself and having to face pictures, it's one thing to hear it, but then to see images of human beings being treated that way, it's just gut-wrenching.
Mm-hmm. It is.
And it's institutionalized terrorism. Like you said, it's meant to make a statement.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's fascinating, going back to the Italians and Jews, that particularly Meyer Lansky and Lucky Luciano in Borgata, Rise of Empire, after the period of the New Orleans incident with the lynch mobs. And I know that there was a lot of bouncing around of these mafiosos from Sicily and different parts mm-hmm. of Italy. They would come to America to flee being locked up over there. They would come here, then they would go back and then maybe end up in New York, right? So there's a rotating Rolodex of figures that did this. And then by the time that things began to be established after the Black Hand and the big rush through Ellis Island in New York, a lot of things began to be taken over by these guys who were called Mustache Petes, the old style Dons, right? But then there was this group of people who were working together. And those guys, they didn't really want to work or collaborate too much with people of other ethnicities or other cultures. They were very much in their own bubble as far as Italians or Sicilians. And so the new class of people who came about, namely Lucky Luciano and Meyer Lansky from the Jewish side, I'm fascinated with their relationship. And it's been a very storied one, right? In pop culture, a lot of movies, TV, books, and things that get thrown around to the point where who knows what's really real anymore. But I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that coming together of particularly those two characters, but also in their resistance against the old world dons that were in power.
Absolutely. And so it's absolutely brilliant, this relationship between Meyer Lansky and Charles Lucky Luciano.
Mm-hmm.
A little background, Meyer Lansky's family flees pogroms in Eastern Europe around the same time Lucky Luciano's family leaves Sicily for America. And both families are looking for a better life. Both families are law-abiding, the parents are, and both sons somehow, which leaves us to wonder how corrupt America is, that both sons end up coming from law-abiding homes
right.
and end up becoming criminals on the street. But they meet each other and they become the best of friends. And now there's a crucial figure in their lives that plays a huge role in their upbringing. And his name is Arnold Rothstein.
Right.
And this is attested to by both men and a million other gangsters who I quote, some of them, they attribute Rothstein to being their mentor. He was sort of like the Aristotle of the mob school.
Right.
And Rothstein was a brilliant man. He was considered, quote unquote, the bankroll because he bankrolled, quote unquote, larcenous schemes. Anybody could come to him and say, I'm moving a shipment of heroin. I'm opening up a casino. I'm opening up a bordello. I'm loan sharking money. I'm investing in this. I'm investing in that. And he would listen. And whether it was legal or illegal, he invested in it. And he schooled these gangsters, a lot of these Italian gangsters as well, besides Jewish gangsters. Rothstein was a Jew. But he met Meyer Lansky, believe it or not, of all places, a bar mitzvah. I mean, you take your son to a bar mitzvah, imagine he bumps into Arnold Rothstein,
right?
Right, of all the people. So he meets Rothstein at a bar mitzvah, and then he gets tight with Rothstein. Rothstein wants to continue the relationship, meets him again for dinner, and he becomes Rothstein's protege, and he eventually introduces his childhood pal, Lucky Luciano, to Rothstein. And then Rothstein instills in them the importance of, in America, diversity. He said, look, we're a diverse group here. You're not in Sicily anymore. You're not in Eastern Europe. We got everybody here. We got Irish, we got blacks, we got Armenians, we got Greeks, we got everybody. We got Asians. You got to work with everybody. And that's the only way to succeed here in America. No discriminations, no biases, work with everybody and you'll get far. And then he tells them to circulate in bigger circles. He goes, if you're going to be in the gutter, you're going to never make it anywhere. You're going to always be in the gutter. Try to gravitate towards where higher money circulates and you'll be part of that and you'll be able to grab some of that higher money. This all came from Rothstein. This comes out of their mouths. They say this came from him.
Wow.
He even taught them how to dress. My family from Naples and Sicily, they were very loud, especially the Naboli Dons, the Neapolitans.
Mm-hmm.
They were very loud. You could see them coming from a mile away. They wore bright shirts and they drove big two-tone bright cars. My mother's family. So Luciano used to wear loud clothing and Rothstein said, here, dress in conservative suits. Be low key. Here's a nice suit for you. And he brought him suit shopping, believe it or not.
Wow.
So Luciano said he taught me how to eat with a knife and fork. He didn't mean he taught him how to put food in his mouth. He wasn't a caveman, Luciano. He meant he taught him how to use proper etiquette at the table.
Right.
Where people in a higher circle won't say, look at that animal over there. Look at him eating with a fork. He's got the fork held in like he's got a dagger.
Right.
So this is something that Rothstein taught them. So he took the time to school them and made them the mobsters that they were. Now, at some point, Luciano's got a hybrid crew. He's got tough Italians with him, Vito Genovese, Albert Anastasia, Joe Adonis. And he's got tough Jews with him, Red Levine, Benjamin Bugsy Siegel, right. Meyer Lansky. And he's got this hybrid crew that he's the head of, the boss of, and he's also part of the mafia in New York. So with this hybrid crew, it becomes sort of like a secret crew. They're not like admitted by the quote-unquote mustache Pete you very pointedly spoke of earlier, mm-hmm. which is interesting because they were sort of like the old Greases, the first wave of Italians that came here. Then the Italian-Americans, the next ones, where they came either young or they were born here,
right.
Lansky and Luciano. So they wanted to get rid of the old mentality of the mustache Pete's, which was no Jews. We don't do business with Jews. Or if a Jew's allowed in the room, he can't participate in the conversation. Luciano said, no, that's not what Arnold Rothstein taught me, and it's not what my experiences have proven. We should work with the Jews. No, we don't need to work with the Jews. No, we should. And then at some point or another during Prohibition, Rothstein, two Jews approach him, and they say, look, we're going to stop bringing in liquor through the Great Lakes so the Canadians could supply us with liquor while it's dry here in America. We just need money to buy the fleet of ships and boats and stuff and, you know, the infrastructure. We need $250,000, which was in, I don't know how many millions in today's currency. So Rothstein says, fine, let me think about this. So he comes back to them the next day, Rothstein does, and he says, look, if we were to open up the Great Lakes and have all this liquor coming through, eventually the Canadians are going to squeeze us. I've done business before with people. They're going to eventually know that it's them or nobody.
Right.
I got a distillery over in Scotland that I have a connection with. Why don't we open up the pipeline in Scotland too? And we'll have them coming in from the United Kingdom over there and also to the Great Lakes through Canada. And we can then play off one from another and get the best prices. So Rothstein then starts supplying Lucky Luciano with 12-year-old aged whiskey. Whereas Luciano's other friends in the mob have these overnight distilleries that they're putting together, something they call quote unquote bathtub gin.
Right.
Ripple, moonshine.
Stuff that can make you go blind.
Exactly. People did go blind or some of them dropped dead.
Yeah.
So who are you going to buy from? Gino and Vito, who got this bathtub full of garbage that they just took a bath this morning and then they made a batch of alcohol tonight?
Right.
Or are you going to buy from Luciano, who's got bottled whiskey from the Scottish Highlands? You know, so this is like a no-brainer. Through that connection that Rothstein gave Luciano, Luciano starts getting bigger and bigger and bigger in the mob. because money speaks. The same reason I grew. I was in my early 20s. Why are people in their 40s and 50s listening to me? Because I'm making money.
Right.
And money talks. You don't care who your boss is at a big corporation. If your boss is 12 years old, you don't care if he pays you $250,000 a year as opposed to the 60-year-old who only pays you $100.
Right.
You'd rather have Doogie Howser as the boss, right?
Right.
So now this is how Luciano's starting to make inroads in the mafia. And eventually then through his hybrid crew of Jews and Italians, they make a move to take over one of the Borgatas. And they did it successfully. And I urge all your readers to read the intrigues, the Machiavellian intrigues that I get deep into in the book, Borgata, Rise of Empire. Get into it, read it, and you'll see the genius and savviness of Luciano and Lansky.
Yeah, you do a masterful job referencing traditional philosophers and writers. And I had some other questions written about some of those guys. But no, it's really fascinating where they draw from. Everything from Mazzini's The Duties of Man all the way through, Machiavelli and guys like that.
Good point. Yeah. So then this hybrid crew of Jews and Italians, once they sort of supplant the old mustache Pete's, the old bosses, now they bring their new outlook. They sort of revolutionize the mafia and they Americanize it. You know, we're not like feudal lords anymore in Sicily, where we're going to sit on this big kingly chair and, you know, give orders to people and tell everybody you're the capo di tutto capi, the boss of bosses, no more. And they bring more of a democratic process into it. You know, now we vote. The capos vote when they want to bring a new don in. There's this thing called the commission that Luciano brings into play, where there's a round table and the boss of each of the five Borgatas in New York sit around this round table and everybody has a vote. It's like the League of Nations, which was before the United Nations or the United Nations. This was revolutionary thinking at the time. Luciano came up with it. Even the Sicilians didn't have the commission. They had something called the cupola that they later invented after we formed the commission. They copied ours and called it the cupola.
Oh, wow.
Meaning the top of a building, that the top guys. So Luciano does all this. He says, look, forget about all of these discriminatory attitudes we have towards other ethnic groups. We're all one in America. Sure, to be part of the Brigada or the Borgata, we have to be Italian. If you want to be an initiated, made member of a particular family, you must be 100% Italian. But that doesn't mean we can't deal with everybody. That doesn't mean we can't have choice associates who could be invited into the highest circles with us. And that's what they did. And that was the crucial decision because Lansky, he's an absolute criminal genius. And eventually, him and Siegel are instrumental in making Las Vegas what it became.
Right.
They're instrumental. Lansky specifically was instrumental in opening up Cuba to the mob. And they practically took over Havana through Fulgencio Batista, the dictator before Castro took over, Fidel Castro.
Right.
A lot of these things came through Lansky's brilliant criminal genius mind. And the Italians benefited from it. So they literally made millions of dollars. And then Lansky, even later on in life, helped them hide it in Swiss bank accounts.
Right.
In Liechtenstein, in Luxembourg, in Switzerland, wherever he went. He showed them, this is how we hide money. And basically, you know, the mob benefited from this relationship and it speaks volumes to us as a people, you know, to deal with everybody. Whenever we do all these sanctions, how many decades are we going to squeeze the Cuban people because we don't like Castro? Come on, you're going to do better by showing people. You know, open the world up. I wrote about that, my international bestseller, Mob Rules, What the Mafia Can Teach a Legitimate Businessman.
Yes.
It's 20 languages. I speak about that thoroughly, how the mob has an idea of they don't school people and say, well, if you don't have the same beliefs as us, we're not going to deal with you. Ha. The mafia had gay bars when nobody wanted gays. You know, the gays went through hell in the United States and around the world
for
I don't know how many centuries until Oscar Wilde was locked up.
Right.
Sexual.
Yeah, they basically killed that man. Yeah.
Yeah. And here you have the mob before the gay rights movement and everything. The mob opens up gay bars throughout the village. The mob owned and controlled almost every, if not every, gay bar in Greenwich Village. The Genovese family specifically and the Gambino family had a few of them. Why? You're not allowed to be gay in the mob. They'll kill you if you are gay. If you're a member and they find out you're gay, you're dead.
Right.
But that doesn't mean we can't deal with gays. That doesn't mean that you can't make money with gays. And it's a crucial attitude that made the mafia so much money, this non-discriminatory attitude. I remember when I took over a club in Manhattan, and I remember the guy came to us, me and my friends, and he says, look, I'm going to tell you right now, our best night is gay night. Don't give it up.
Yeah.
He goes, they spend big money, the gays, and they never cause problems like heterosexual men. I forget what he used for the term heterosexual men. He says they don't cause problems. He goes, guys are fighting over broads. They're breaking each other's heads open. They're breaking glasses and cutting each other's throats. He goes, we never have a problem on gay night. He goes, they're nice. They spend big money at the bar and they don't bother anybody. We kept gay night. It was our best night. So imagine if I was discriminatory towards gays. I would have lost all that money.
Right.
And the mob knew that. And that came from the revolution that Luciano brought to the mob, a different way of thinking. Don't discriminate against anyone, anyone. Even my attitude, my first book deal came from Bill Yosis. Bill Yosis is gay. Bill Yosis became the White House chef under the Bush administration, pastry chef,
right,
and continued under the Obama administration. He made the cake for the queen. He made the cake for the Pope. And he's an incredible man, a beautiful man. I love Bill with all my heart. Had I been discriminatory, I would have never got my first book deal because Bill Yosis said, you're an amazing writer. I need to introduce you to an agent. Now, I'm not gay. I never had a gay thought in my life. I'm a complete alpha male. But had I been discriminatory towards gays, I'd have never gotten that first book deal.
Right.
So I would never even think of that. I would never even consider that. And the Italian mafia wasn't. It's a lesson to learn.
That's fascinating. I wonder about the title of the book, Borgata, Rise of Empire. The term Borgata, it went away somewhere around this same period. Is the change in philosophy something to do with why that went away? The change in the language and the way we think and speak in these organizations?
Definitely. Words change. America, the corporate structure of America, as opposed to the very dictatorial structure of Sicily, even though Sicily did become a liberal democracy after the unification of Italy, but they were still very dictatorial on the island.
Very much influenced by sort of feudalism. You mentioned that a good bit in the book.
Exactly. And they controlled the ballot boxes even after they became democratic. You know,
right,
the mafia did. You still had to go to the old Don in the piazza if you wanted something done. You didn't go to your local politician because the local politician took orders from the Don.
Right.
And in America, that happened too. The American mafia corrupted so many politicians in America. They had complete control over New York's Tammany Hall. They had control over the Pendergast machine in Kansas City. They controlled a lot of these Democratic and Republican machines throughout the country. And they just bribed politicians. We always had a corrupt system in America. But anyway, getting back to the word changes, the word Don or father, padrino,
right,
was used in the beginning. And then it became boss.
Right.
Well, boss is a direct reflection of America's corporate culture.
Right.
What is boss? My boss. I work for a boss. You don't work for a Don or a Padrino or a Padre, or you work for a boss. So the boss now is the boss in Italian. He's a mob boss. He used to be the Don. Those are word changes, Bugada, Brugada, you become a crew or a
right,
family, right? These are things that change, and I trace a lot of those. I like etymology, so I trace a lot of the etymological roots throughout, which I enjoy doing. I trace the original word. Nobody's ever done this before. Nobody ever knew where the word mafia came from, and I traced it to the word Mahdi. I urge listeners again to read the book and to see how I put the pieces together to show how the word Mahdi, I believe, is the root word for the word mafia.
Didn't you mention that the etymology of that is actually Arabic?
It is.
Yeah.
It is indeed. Yep. So the Arabs were, at one point or another, after the Arabs, one of the many rulers Sicily had, the Arabs were pushed into Western Sicily, which is like Agrigento, Palermo regions. And that's where the mafia was founded. Those were the mafia's founding fathers in those areas. Those people, rather specifically, I traced to be the mafia's founding fathers, the Arab Sicilians. And there's a lot of, first of all, architectural landscape of Sicily in those areas are very highly influenced by Arabs. There are churches that look like mosques in those regions of Sicily, in all of Sicily. There were runes that still could be seen, Greco-Roman runes, but also Arab stuff.
Yeah, they have very identifiable iconography and specific decoration. They're beautiful decorations that they have.
Absolutely. And I found that, you know, I found that to be interesting myself. And then I noticed a lot of words and a lot of things the mob does, even a lot of attitudes came directly from Arab culture. So I started reading books on the Arabs. I wanted to learn more about the Arabs and the Bedouin, specifically like Bedouin tribes that were very patriarchal, were identical to the original mafia families.
Wow.
And an extended tribe was basically a family that sort of like then invited non-familial roots, you know, people into the, and it was the same thing with the mafia. What is a mafia family? A mafia family is, might be heavily Gambino or Castellano relatives, but then it begins to take in the Ferrante, the Russo. And, you know, what are we? Are we part of the family? Yeah, we're part of the family, but we're really like an extended family. We're like blood, you know, blood brothers through oath or bond,
right,
but not necessarily through bloodline. So this is exactly the way a lot of times, you know, I saw these interesting comparisons, and I noticed that the geographically speaking, the Arab Berbers specifically were in certain parts of Sicily where the mafia seemed to arise. And then I was able to trace the word Mahdi when Italy proper was pushing and, you know, pressuring Sicily to fall in line with the government of Italy and the rest of Western Europe. You're going to fall in line with us. You're no more a feudal society. You're going to do what we tell you to do now. You're part of Italy. The Sicilians resisted. fiercely. And the biggest resistance were the Arab Berbers. And the resistance movements throughout Islamic times were known as the Mahdi. The Mahdi was the guy who sort of arose and was thought of as like a descendant of some sort of Muhammad. And he arose during times when Islam was pressured by maybe the West or somebody else was, you know, strangling the Islamic culture. And this Mahdi would say, I'll save you. So, and the Mahdi specifically would be his regime. The followers of the Mahdi were known as the Mahdist regime or the Mahdiyya, which was only a single letter away from mafia.
Yeah. Wow.
And that's where I traced the word mafia. And I put a lot more evidence in the book. Once again, I urge your readers to read it. I make a strong case that that's the word. I leave it for future historians to debate, but that's where I believe it came from.
I agree. And Lewis, you've done a fascinating job of being a unique source for this kind of material. We talked a little bit about this before the interview, but like having a way of laying out academically and historically so many accounts and so much data and referencing it also classically through your bibliography and references so that to give us context and everything while at the same time having your own voice as a person who was in this life very much firsthand. And that's the big difference, right, between you writing a book like this as opposed to anyone who's ever written a book like this.
Yes. No one, when I was in jail, thank you, by the way, and when I was in prison, I wanted to leave crime behind. So I only read books about, as I said, history, philosophy, literature. I taught myself how to write by reading the masters of 19th century fiction, Masters and Mistresses, the Bronte sisters, Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, Flaubert, Hugo, Balzac. So that's how I sort of learned how to teach myself how to write. And I never wanted to read true crime. But everybody around me, if they did read, very few people did, but if they did, they tended to read true crime because it was something they knew and understood. They're criminals.
Right.
So I would hear a lot of guys, Italian guys, mob guys, reading the mafia. And I would constantly hear a lot of blurting out like, bullshit, never happened, no way, come on. You know, and I'd hear that. So I knew the books couldn't be that accurate. I'd say, okay, you know, whatever they're reading, they must just be being, you know, they're obviously frustrated over it. Because we know how the life is lived and we know what's true and what's not. You got a certain ring, you know, an alarm goes off in your head, an alert if something's off. You know, if you're an architectural engineer and you walk into a meeting and there's five or six architectural engineers and then there's two guys who run a hot dog stand and they start telling you about architecture, aren't you going to spot them immediately and go, hey, go back to your hot dog stand. I don't know how you snuck into this meeting. We know if it's a Harvard graduate or a Yale or a Princeton graduate telling us about the mafia because he studied it in school or something. So we usually kind of like have that extra sense that says, okay, this guy's got it all wrong. There's no way. And not to take away anybody's Ivy League education, but, you know, there are certain things that we know from having lived it. You have to feel what it is to have a handcuff around your wrist and what it is to live in a cell to understand prison. You have to feel what it is to hold a gun in your hand and to pull the trigger to understand what the mafia is like or to stick somebody up or, you know, have to hijack trucks. John Gotti was a hijacker when he came up the hard way. You know, so he knows. To me, John Gotti was a better Don than someone like Paul Castellano because John Gotti understood what it is to hijack a truck. He understands me. He knows what I go through. Paul Castellano never had to do those things. He came from mafia royalty. So there's differences, but we know if somebody knows the life. That's not to say Castellano didn't understand the life. He did. Gotti did too, but Gotti understood it more because he knew it from the bottom. So that said, when I finally started to research for my book, I realized that all the things those guys were blurting out about, I came across the same stuff probably because I started blurting the same things. And I knew if a story was repeated a million times over the course of the last 40 or 50 years, I knew if it was true or not. And I don't expect the reader to just take my word for it. As you saw, what I do in the book is I tell you why it didn't happen and why, and then I explain to you why it couldn't have never happened. And then I explain to you what probably happened because I want the reader to start to think like a mafioso, to start to understand how I think. and I bring you on a ride. So you're learning as you go, so that by time the end of the book, by time volume two comes, you'll know if you're hearing the truth or not. Or if you pick up another book, you'll know if you're hearing the truth or not. You'll know, because you should have that sort of like background where I'm telling you, this could have never happened, and this is why. This is how we do things. It's not that way. You know, if I watched the White House, if I watched politics, let's say, on the news for years, that doesn't mean I could write a biography or a history of the Oval Office. You need someone who was in there to write it. And I'm a strong believer. That's why, obviously, people contract people to write things they know about. And that's why I feel like I was the first one who had lived that life, but also gave myself the education where I could say, I'm an historian as well. And it's the first time I think that anybody could say, I could wear both hats. And hopefully the readers agree. And that's what thus far has been the value of the book, I feel.
I think that's definitely demonstrated in the book. And, I think that I remember in another interview that you had given that you had mentioned, and I think that you also mentioned it in some of the foreword, which is why you felt compelled to write this, is because you are very capable and in a very unique position to wear both those hats. And it reminds me of something that you mentioned also, that you said, courts tell convenient lies. And I think that when you said it, it was in reference to courts. And again, there's plenty of parallels that can be drawn between organized crime and the court system, or, you know, larger entities in America, whether they be corporate or government. But these convenient lies were taken advantage of by gangsters as well. And I think one of the most fascinating ones to me that you really do a great job of explaining why you believe that it is a convenient lie is the assassination of Maranzano.
Mm-hmm.
When sort of the tale goes that he had enlisted Mad Dog Cole, this Irish sort of ne'er-do-well gangster that was supposedly going to knock off all these very powerful, tough gangsters, including Lucky Luciano. And that's like, even in the movie Mobsters, it's the narrative that's presented to us. Mm-hmm. But you do you do a good job of dispelling this and explaining why the mentality of maybe, you know, who actually did come up with that narrative.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm glad you pointed that one out. I really appreciate you pointing that out, because it struck me immediately as not true.
Sure.
You have all these old mustache Petes who only dealt with their own, only Sicilians. And suddenly he's going to entrust the biggest move he's ever going to make in his entire life to this, as you said, this never-do-well, who is also an Irishman. And not to say that Luciano and Lansky didn't have relationships with Irishmen, but the old Sicilians didn't.
Right.
They only had relationships with themselves. And all of a sudden, we're supposed to believe he's entrusting everything to this guy, and he's creating a hit list. And I realized at some point that Lucky Luciano invented the whole hit list, because Luciano, the people on the list speak volumes about who created the list. No one on the list, the only people on the list were people that Luciano still needed to win over to his cause.
Right.
So he could say to them, hey, you're on Maranzano's hit list. Did you know that? I am.
Right.
I'll kill that SOB.
Yeah.
But the most dangerous people around Luciano somehow didn't make the list. That struck me as odd. Why wouldn't they make the list? Why wouldn't Maranzano, was smart enough, if he was going to do this, if he was going to entrust his whole life to some never-do-well who was also not a Sicilian, if he was going to do all that, if we could get past all of that, which I couldn't, but if we could, then he's not going to kill the most dangerous people around Luciano. He's going to pick all these other people and only the people that Luciano really needs to win over. So it struck me immediately as all that. So I kind of outline it for the reader so they understand it. There was another instance where I had inside information where apparently at the end of my book, we talk about the passing of Frank Costello, and there's a mausoleum.
Right.
And
right.
Another gangster. Yeah. The papers and history books and documentaries have told us ad nauseum that this guy, Carmine Lillo Galante, got out of prison and he hated Costello and he always hated him. And he was mad that Costello died when he was in jail. So he affixed the bomb to his mausoleum and he blew up the doors. I said to myself, you think a mob boss who's used to dealing with multi-millions of dollars and commanding an army, is going to do a crime that a child would do. You know, he's going to do vandalism just to prove a point, and there's no value to it, and it's just to blow up somebody's mausoleum. I got him. That's not, it's ridiculous. That's like saying in his spare time, Galante spray painted the subway because he didn't like the transit authority. You know, come on. So I immediately saw this as I talked to a friend of mine. He says, Lou, we blew the doors off that. I says, really? Why? He goes, we were after the gold. We figured Costello was never buried with any, he had no children or grandchildren. We figured he must have been buried with at least a solid gold watch, maybe gold chains. Who knows? We figured it was something in his casket, rings, gold rings. He always wore things. He always had expensive watches on, gold rings. And we knew he didn't have any relatives, you know, any offspring. So I said, you're kidding me. So I said, well, he goes, Lou, the other thing was gold. If you look, when Costello died, I checked this. Gold was like $30 an ounce. It shot to $300 an ounce when they did this.
Yeah, so you listed proof. That in the book. That's amazing.
I listed it. So there's proof now. Now you have evidence. There was another stitch of evidence I found later, and I didn't put in the book, but I found this after. I found a newspaper article that said the body was tampered with. So if Galante affixed the bomb to the doors and ran, why was the body tampered with? The body was tampered with because my friend was looking for gold.
Right.
You know, he was much older than me. Obviously, the guy's much older than me now. You know, this happened in the early 70s. So, you know, I was 5 years old when this happened. But he was, you know, he's an older man now. But he told me. So I was able to dispel that myth by direct testimony, direct evidence. You know, obviously he told me, don't tell anybody I told you. He's not the proudest guy in the world of that. You know, grave digging isn't something even criminals brag about.
Right.
But nonetheless, I was able to dispel myths, some that I saw, most 90% of them in volume one, that I was able to see firsthand and explain to the reader why this could have never happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that was one of my favorite parts of the book. That's so special, again, that you're able to wear both those hats and really dispel some things. And it was, and with very valid and substantial evidence and rationale behind it. Mm-hmm. And it was, some of it was really fascinating. And again, being someone who's been a pretty avid sort of nerd about reading the history of the mafia, a lot of these things were sort of narratives that I just assumed, oh, that must have been how it went. But, you know, looking at it through the lens that you provide, it makes a lot of sense that a lot of what we assume is just not the case. And
I think I was the first one to do that, which is hopefully it makes an impact on people.
Yeah. And it brings me to a couple other, I just got a few more questions and it just sort of maybe specific ones. I think that it's fascinating. And you address this a little bit in the book and you actually, you do a good job of pretty quickly imparting why you believe it to be the case that J. Edgar Hoover was so adamant that the mafia did not exist as a large operation or entity. There was not some, you know, commission. He just, till the day he died, denied that. And why do you think that is?
I outlined it in the book. And I came to the conclusion that a lot of people said Hoover was patriotic. He was a very patriotic American. He was obviously power hungry, control freak, and all of that other stuff. But that's not to say he wasn't patriotic and he didn't believe in America.
Right.
And everything says that he does and did. So what was it? Why did he ignore the mob? Why didn't he want to investigate the mob for so long? Bobby Kennedy, which begins volume two of my trilogy,
right,
brings him to the table kicking and screaming. Why was he so resistant to the idea of investigating the mafia? Well, some people said, well, the mob had, they had photos of him. It's now believed that that he was gay.
Right.
Hoover was.
Or at least a cross-dresser or something like that, right?
At least, at the very least, a cross-dresser. So, you know, could it be that he's a drag queen? Could it be that he's gay? You know, I don't know. You know, I'm open to anything. Let's see. There was no evidence that the mob ever had anything on him like that. It's just talk. So I felt that came from rumors that he was maybe, you know, okay, I think he's a drag queen. Okay, we're pretty sure he's gay. And now let's say that the mob had photos of him because there must be a reason. But the photos never surfaced. So that doesn't mean it's untrue. But it made me, okay, let me continue to look. And then I found that some people said he used to give Frank Costello specifically, used to give him big racehorsing tips. And Hoover made a ton of money with the tips, so he stayed away from the mafia.
Right.
Hoover would probably stay, if that were true. First of all, I don't think Hoover would sell out his country for a racehorsing bet. That's number one.
Sure.
But from what I gather of Hoover, and I read quite a few biographies about him, and did a tremendous amount of research. I could have wrote a biography on Hoover myself when I was done. But I did not feel that he would sell his country out for a happy day at the racetrack. Did Costello give him tips? Yes, there's evidence that Costello did give him tips. Did he bet? Yes, he loved betting the ponies. So he was a bettor. But he wouldn't sell out his country for that. And even if he was indebted to Costello for that, he might lay his hands off Costello, but that doesn't mean he's got to lay his hands off the entire mafia across the Eastern Seaboard or the United States. So it didn't make sense to me either. I kept digging. At some point or another, there was an ex-FBI guy who gave me a lead, and then I found a ton of evidence to support it. Hoover was afraid that the FBI, his FBI, who he prided himself, the FBI was a direct reflection of Hoover.
Sure.
And he prided himself. I mean, it was almost like Frederick the Great's army. Frederick the Great used to have, like, you know, soldiers that, or you know, that he wanted them to, you know, be very, you know, big and, you know, handsome. And I think Catherine the Great's husband did that too before they whacked him in his bed. He had a little army of soldiers that he wanted to look a certain way. Well, yeah. Hoover wanted that of his agents. Hoover wanted them to look a certain way, dress a certain way, act a certain way. He was very, very controlling. But he felt that his agents would show up poorly if they started arresting the mob for a number of reasons. He felt that the mob could buy juries. The mob could pay off judges. The mob could hire the best attorneys, whereas a government attorney could be great, could be bad, could be mediocre. So you have the mob who sort of like would show up a lot better than the FBI in a courtroom back then. And the next thing you had, because Hoover had his ear to the streets, he knew that the mob was buying a lot of people. Sometimes they owned ward leaders. Sometimes they owned a mayor. Sometimes they owned the governor. And they took a stab at times at owning the president and wanted to. That came to a head when they attempted to own Kennedy at some point later.
Sure.
But they tried to take, they took a stab at owning at the 1932 Democratic National Convention. They took a stab at helping FDR, hoping that he would give them something in return. And then he double crossed them.
Right. Which Luciano, I thought was another fascinating part of the book also. I thought that was really fascinating. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And Roosevelt was sly. I mean, I'm a huge fan of Roosevelt, by the way. I feel like his leadership during World War II was crucial to us winning World War II.
Yeah, he was a masterful politician.
Absolute genius, exactly. But he was very sly. And an example of how sly he was is when he was, you know, he knew MacArthur had aspirations of running for president one day. And when he met MacArthur one time in the Pacific, there was right before a photo shoot, he noticed that MacArthur had his fly open. And he nodded over to the photographer and he's trying to give him the eye to take a picture quick of MacArthur with his fly open. And MacArthur caught it and zipped up his fly really quick before the photographer hopped into place. That was how sly Roosevelt was. But Roosevelt made a lot of promises to the mob and then double-crossed them. And Luciano, who was a pragmatist all his life, said, "I don't take offense to it." He goes, "He did exactly what I would have done if I was in his position."
I love it. Yeah, he admired it. He admired him for it.
He admired it. Can you imagine? No hard feelings.
Yeah.
This is what I would have. And Luciano was a master double-crosser. So, you know, never double-crossed Lansky because that was his man. But he double-crossed a lot of other people.
Right.
So, and he admired it, just like you said. It was, you know, it's like it was even better than just accepting it. He admired it.
He, like, tipped his hat to him in a way.
Exactly. And what, you know, what is your Constitution made up of when you could be that far above humanity? Like the rest of us, I'd be petty. I'd be like, that SOB, I'd have to curse myself dry for the next 2 hours.
Yeah.
Luciano in a split second said, "Who cares? He did what I would have did." You know, so that's interesting. And it shows you it's the mind of a leader. So the next thing is Hoover, getting back to Hoover, is he knew he couldn't compete with the mob. They own congressmen.
Right.
At the time, I don't believe they were, you know, it was mostly congressmen. So he owned congressmen, he owned senators, they owned senators. They own too many people. And I'm going to start losing cases and I'll look foolish. And then what am I going to do too? Trace a lead that goes back to Washington, D.C.
Right.
Do I trace a lead that goes back to the governor's office, the governor's mansion? What do I do here? So Hoover, who loved America, was more interested in people who were, he focused more on bank robbers who were easy to catch and easy to put away and gun them down because right. it's just, you know, one or two people doing it. Okay, that's easy. Communism and other, you know, this is who he considered a threat to American institutions were communists, for example. This is a capitalist system. I don't want communists infiltrating our capitalist system. So he focused his attention on communists. He didn't feel like the mob was ever a threat to American institutions. In fact, they may have been a benefit to America in ways that, such as when, you know, a pressure valve, when America had no alcohol, the mob provided it.
Right.
That's a pressure valve. That's a societal pressure valve. And when the prostitution is illegal in New York, the mob organized all the bordellos. So that's sort of like a pressure valve for people. You know, otherwise, you know, you get people who are hard up, maybe doing the wrong things at times. You know, so that's sort of, you know, and they were controlling the spread of diseases, the mob was. They had doctors on the payroll. They didn't want diseases to be spread, not because they cared for the sanctity of these poor working women, but because they didn't want diseases being spread to the Johns and you know, and then nobody visits the bordellos when everybody gets diseases.
Right.
So, you know, it was again, money. It was profit, right? So anyway, though, getting back to Hoover once again, he wasn't as interested in the mafia. He didn't consider them a threat to the American institutions. The mafia loved America. When World War II came around, they wanted to help the American effort to win the war. They helped naval intelligence at the docks, which I cover thoroughly. And the mafia, in every which way, wanted America to succeed because they loved its corrupt system. They loved that the government was easily corruptible. They loved the democratic system because they could control the ballot boxes. They could give big campaign donations to different politicians who were easily bought and paid for. So the mafia wasn't a threat to American institutions, as opposed to maybe a dozen hippies chanting anti-war slogans, which would drive Hoover up a wall.
Right.
So, I mean, there's a perfect example of what Hoover was more concerned with. So that's why he had a hands-off approach to the mob, in my opinion. And I think I outline it. I think I made a very good case for that in the book. I don't feel it had anything to do with homosexuality or drag queening or anything like that. I believe the mob would have known to leave Hoover's private life to himself. That's his private life. Let him live it. You know, I don't think that they had anything on him. I think it came out, you know, over the years or something. I think that was just a myth because no one could figure out why he had a hands-off approach. And when that was, you know, that was what I feel when he just didn't want to tangle with them.
Yeah, and it's one of many of your theories that just really check out, as opposed to what's often just been thrown at us as the easy answer of why this or that happened. And this is something that usually these easy answers are often a consensus among, you know, historians and things like that. But it's a testament to how when you look under the rug, what you might find. And in this volume one, Borgata, Rise of Empire, you round off. There's still so much I'd love to still talk to you about, but I want to go ahead and finish up the interview with just this one part of the book that you leave us with that I thought was a fascinating sort of allegory. And it's after the deaths of we go over Albert Anastasia, Lucky Luciano, very fascinating the way that they both very differently passed away, met their end, along with setting us up for what's about to happen with the Kennedys and Santo Traficante Jr., who I'm also fascinated with in multiple ways. But you end with this allegory about a man called Diamond Pitt. Can you talk a little bit about that story and how the rise of the mafia is so closely associated with the history and rise of America, particularly when it comes to wealth and where that comes from?
Yeah, you're a great reader. Wow, I'm so happy you pointed that out. You're
Thanks.
My target audience.
Thanks,
you are
man.
My target audience. Yeah, you're my target audience. So the end of volume one, we reach a point where we've started in sort of roughly 1860 Sicily, although I go back into before that.
Right.
Roughly 1860s Sicily to 1960s America. So it's basically the first 100 years of the mafia on two continents, beginning there and ending here. And around the 1960s, something is happening. A lot of the people who came over and a lot of the people who were born into the life or were young when they got involved in the life, they're starting to, the Jews are leaving in mass to start with, first of all. So the Jews were very, very influential in the American mafia. And I wanted to point that out. But the Jews are leaving in mass. And why are the Jews leaving before we get to why the Italians leave? The Jews are leaving in mass because they only did this because the opportunities weren't there for them. The Jews were discriminated against when they got here.
Right.
And they couldn't go on a golf course until recently. So they were golf courses until I was a kid that didn't open up. We don't want Jews. There probably still exists some where even if it's not institutional, it's in word. We'd rather not have those Jews. And anti-Semitism is even creeping up more and more as we speak.
Yeah.
But and the Jews were, though, severely discriminated against. So the opportunities were lacking. And a lot of them that went into the underworld, while they were in the underworld over the next several decades, the institutional discrimination began to lift in America. And there was less discrimination, institutionally speaking, in corporate America. And the Jews now were acceptable. So you don't have to be a gangster in the gutter. You could get an office. You could get the corner office in a skyscraper now. You could run a company. You could work on Wall Street. You could do this. You could do that. As this discrimination begins to lift, the Jews say, well, I did this for myself, but I don't want my kids following in these footsteps. They don't need to know what a gun is and a stiletto.
Right.
So they're sort of weaning away from it. You know, then they're getting their kids. My kids need to go to school. My kids need to study Torah when they're young and go to Hebrew school and then go to college when they're older, become a dentist, become a doctor, become a lawyer. And they're pushing them into professional positions or open up a company or do this or do that, but don't go this way. Well, at the same time, a lot of Italian Americans are doing the same thing. Not all. And that's why we have a volume two.
Right.
But a lot of Italian Americans are saying, you know, Tommy Lucchese, for example, the founding father of the Lucchese family, which is still active today.
Right.
Tommy Three-Finger Brown Lucchese, who, by the way, is another story, but my father knew him. My father used to hang out at a bowling alley and play cards.
Oh, wow.
And my father wasn't a gangster in any way, shape, or form. My father was a regular guy, but he knew him. He was friendly with Tommy Lucchese's paisan, who was my father's – the paisan's son was my father's best friend. So that's how that happened. But anyway, Tommy Lucchese – did not want his kids involved in that life. He sent one son to West Point. He sent his daughter, I think, went to Vassar. You know, he wanted his kids to be educated and get the hell away from this.
Right.
This wasn't life. And a lot of Italian Americans did that. And they said, look, we made a ton of money. Now it's time to wash it. And now I use the analogy with Pitt. When Pitt, Diamond Pitt, bought that stolen diamond in India, he eventually resold it for a ton of money, and then he eventually bought estates and consolidated estates in England. And then one kid became the earl of this, another one became the earl of that, another one became the this of that and the this of the other thing. And then we got Pitt the Younger, Pitt the Older, Pittsburgh, all from Pitt.
Yeah.
Pitt, basically, the diamond, that stolen diamond, helped him to become rich. But then our Pitt's kids – criminals? No. The money was washed at some point, and the kids became pillars of society in all these different ways. And the mob had the same effect. Most of their kids went into industry. I can't say because they're still active. There are mafiosos, children and grandchildren of mafiosos who I know today, who if you told them, you know who your grandfather was? They'll go, no, they don't want to know. Because they don't want to admit at the big ritzy titsy banquets that they go to
right.
that the money started mob money, but that's where it started, and I know the truth. And, you know, we laugh about it sometimes, me and my friends who know who the grandchildren are and, you know, the offspring of these mafiosos. And we know where the original mafia came from. But they washed the money, and a lot of Italians then left with the Jews. And they said, look, this was good for one generation, but that's it. We don't need our kids subjected to the possibility of being garroted in the middle of the night or stabbed 27 times or shot 13 times and cut in half and shoved in a barrel. I don't want that for my son.
Right.
But then there are the ones who were schooled and born in Omerta. And those are the ones who believe in the life. And I knew plenty of them too, where the father brings the son in, he brings the grandson in, he brings the nephew in, the grandfather brings the kids in, and they believe in this life till death do us part. And a perfect example is John Gotti. John Gotti brought his son, John Jr., into the life. Now, here's a personal story. I'm not sure if John Gotti ever spoke about it or not. John Gotti Jr., he may have. But I knew personally from the Gottis that when that happened, John Gotti's wife, who I used to see all the time at Peter Gotti's house, because John Gotti's wife was close with Peter Gotti's wife, mm-hmm. and they were nicest ladies you ever met in your life. No airs about them. Hi, Louie, come in. Have a cup of coffee and a piece of cake with us. Wait, while you're waiting for Peter, just sit down. Come on, Louie, tell us what's going on. The nicest ladies you ever met. Well, John Gotti's wife apparently said to John, you took one. You're not taking my other son. Because she lost one, by the way.
One was killed in a car wreck, right?
Right, and John and Peter were left.
By a neighbor who was driving a car, right? Yeah. And that unfortunate person also didn't meet a good end either.
No, he got killed, yeah. So the mother said, look, you took one, I get the other one. So there was a little bit of a domestic dispute over that. But that's a perfect example.
Yeah.
John Gotti, as opposed to Tommy Lucchese, said, I don't want my kids anywhere near this. John Gotti said, I love this. La Cosa Nostra until we die. My son, if it's good enough for me, it's good enough for my son. And this is why we have a volume two, because those are the Italians that kept it going. And then obviously there was no lack of recruits who came to it, i.e. Louis Ferrante, myself.
Sure.
There's always somebody who, you know, doesn't know there are other opportunities in life or gravitates to that for any number of reasons. And then we fill the ranks. You know, there are people who, and then those sons, by the way, and grandsons are known to us as like sort of like mafia royalty.
Right.
Castellano, one of them. Castellano was the nephew and cousin at the same time, because they were sort of like an inbred family, but the nephew and cousin of Carlo Gambino, Castellano was.
Right.
So he was like mafia. Yeah, he's considered mafia royalty, you know? And, a guy like John Gotti came up from nothing. And, you know, those are the guys, though, that mafia royalty, those guys, they controlled the garbage. They controlled the unions. They controlled the meat market. They controlled the waterfront. They controlled... And a guy like John Gotti comes up and says, what's left for me? Just scraps.
Right.
And that's why one of the impetus for him taking over is we got to share the spoils. It's a French revolutionary attitude where, you know, enough, off with the head, you know, this royal family or the czars, you know, enough with Nicholas, you know, the czars have been, controlling Russia for too long. It's time for the working man under Lenin and Stalin and Trotsky to take over.
Right.
So that's sort of what Ron's rebellion was. You know, get rid of the royal families who controlled everything and bring it back down to the lower ranks. But that's sort of, you know, how that went down.
Well, yeah, and it's fascinating, and I'm looking forward to volume two. And like you said, like a Trafficante Jr. would be another example of why there's a volume two, because he was, you know, he was groomed by his father in that life as well, right?
He was indeed. And he plays a huge part in volume two. I touch on him in volume one, toward the end of volume one.
Yeah, because he was actually, I didn't realize he was so heavily involved during the Cuban Revolution that he was actually imprisoned and was he even tortured by that?
Oh, I can't wait for you to read volume two.
I get
into that deeply. Oh, yeah. So volume two, which is subtitled Clash of Titans, will be out the end of this year.
Okay.
And volume two, I go very deep into Trafficante takes center stage with quite a few other mobsters who play prominent roles with the CIA in the attempted overthrow of Fidel Castro.
Right.
And then it somehow it somehow boomerangs back to the United States, those conspiracies.
Right.
And I believe I lay out a very, very good good argument that the mob, rogue agents of the CIA, and Cuban exiles who were trained by the CIA are the ones who were responsible. Those three parties were the co-conspirators involved in the Kennedy assassination, which plays a big part in my volume too. And once again, I keep the same thread as I did in volume one, where I lay out an argument. I don't just tell the reader something. I never want to do that. I never want to say to the reader, oh, this could have never happened, and it had to be this. I always make a go at explaining why. I want the reader to understand and think like I do.
I think that you do a really fantastic job of that, because I knew that that was something that would be a part of at least this volume one. And it's never just short. You don't feel shortchanged by the theories that you present in any way, because they're not only just very well researched, but they're well thought through. The rationale behind them makes total sense, and you also set the reader up for understanding that rationale and that mentality.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Matt.
And you know,
you're my target reader.
Well, glad to be. And again, I'd love to talk to you about, I can't wait to read volume two, and I want to talk to you about what happened to Santo Trafficante Jr. also, because I, being a little bit of a reader myself, I have my own theories about that, but I'm very curious about what your
great. And I look forward to coming back on for volume two.
Oh, fantastic. Absolutely.
That'd be great.
Yeah. And I just, again, I want to take this opportunity to say how inspiring your personal journey has been, you know, to come from your experiences in that life and then to learn from it and then take your penance and then, you know, have a miracle happen, get out so that you can actually take these gifts and give them back to society. It's commendable and really impressive.
Thank you so much, Matt. That's really complimentary. I greatly appreciate that.
No, and it's been a pleasure. It's been a real pleasure to have read this book and to have this conversation. Thank you so much, Louis. Louis Ferrante.
Louis Ferrante is the author of Borgata, Rise of Empire, A History of the American Mafia, which is published by Pegasus Books. The second installment of the trilogy, Borgata, Clash of Titans, is scheduled to be released in November 2024. Matt Ward was your host today. I'm Stephen Ussery, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is produced in the studios of FM 89.3 WYPL Memphis, a service of the Memphis Public Library, a division of the City of Memphis. Book Talk is copyrighted by the Memphis Public Library, all rights reserved.